Hello and welcome to WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And we are here to talk about Halo.
Yes, finally.
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 It's coming. Oh boy. So, tomorrow, November 6th, we're choosing the next president of the United States. But we're also...
That's not... Who gives a shit about that?
Yeah. Halo 4 comes out.
Yeah, Halo 4 comes out.
And perfect distraction from the election stuff. Whether it goes your way or not, it's like, you'll just be able to sink into the, like, warm bask of Halo and stay there as long as you need to.
Yep. I mean, it's almost kind of tragic in a way that we didn't get Halo 4 earlier, so you could have just, like, immerse yourself in Halo 4 and avoid the oppressiveness of, like, the campaign ads and stuff like that.
I know. I mean, the thing that sucks is we've had to watch all the trailers on YouTube preceded by, you know, Mitt Romney telling us horrible things about Barack Obama.
Yeah, so Barack Obama telling us horrible things about Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
And all of them completely untrue on both sides.
Yes. All the people they've killed, all the regimes they've toppled, whatever you want to say.
All the policies they did not enact.
Yeah. So all the nations they did not come from. But anyway, Halo 4 coming out tomorrow. We could not be more excited. Is that a...
I was just telling Jonathan before we started the podcast that on IGN, they did this two-hour-long live stream that I was going to the other day just sort of sit down. I'll watch a little bit of this. I'm kind of bored. I have some free time. I ended up watching the entire goddamn thing. I watched people play Halo 4 for 2 hours, just play the multiplayer. So if you're super excited about Halo 4 and you're listening to this podcast before it comes out, go watch the IGN live stream for 2 hours.
Were you sitting there with your controller pretending to play along?
Maybe. Maybe.
Alright, so, on this episode of the podcast, we will be basically previewing Halo 4, and that just means, I mean, we don't have any special info that you can get yourself, but we just want to talk about what we're excited for, what we're interested in, what our hopes and dreams for the game are, and, you know, some stuff like that, just sort of gush about all the things that excite us before it comes out tomorrow. And then, but for the most part, we're going to be sort of doing a retrospective of the Halo series itself. Now, we did a Halo episode last year, Sean, last November.
Yes, before we were part of WGTC Radio.
Yes, this was when we were the Monthly 10 podcast. You can find that in iTunes still. And it was the November episode of that show. We were a monthly show back then. And so I would recommend that episode. I think it was really good.
Yeah, and we talked a lot more about Halo than I think we will in this podcast. We went into depth about a lot of different subjects. Yeah.
I think that was definitely more structured. We had a couple of top 10 lists we did, like our favorite campaign missions, favorite weapons, favorite maps. And so this is going to be more sort of freeform, just talking about memories of the series, general opinions, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So if you really want more of a sort of structured look at Halo, or at least Halo up to that point in time, that was when Anniversary was coming out, definitely listen to that episode. It will be linked in the show notes on We Got This Covered. So you can go look there, and you can also find it in iTunes again under the Monthly 10 podcast, which obviously has nothing new coming into it, but the old episodes are archived. So before we get started, just sort of jumping into the discussion, anything you want to say, like any life stuff going on, Sean?
Not really. Like I said, I mean, you can tell how much is going on in my life based on the fact that I watched 2 hours of other people playing Halo 4 multiplayer before it was released.
Exactly.
So, there you go.
In terms of, like, movie news and stuff, I guess I have the one review I wasn't able to mention last week in terms of, like, films I'd seen was the movie Flight, because I was seeing it that night. And that's with Denzel Washington, the first live-action film Robert Zemeckis has done in 12 years. He finally came back from the weird, uncanny valley of motion capture. Thank you, Robert. And Flight's a great movie. You can go read my full review. Denzel Washington is brilliant.
Does Denzel Washington play a plane?
He plays a pilot.
Oh.
With severe alcoholism.
I was hoping he would be the plane.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
That would be... Is that like in the Cars sequel, Planes?
Yeah.
He'll be the voice of the... That I would actually see that Cars sequel.
I would see Denzel Washington in a Pixar movie. That would be awesome.
Get on that, Pixar!
And Denzel.
Cars on fire. Alright. Anyway, Flight's good. Read the review. We got this covered. And one piece of movie news that I wanted to highlight because I just totally nerded out over it. And I think anyone who probably listens to us... probably would, too. You probably have similar interests. And that is that The Hobbit soundtrack was announced. It's coming out December 11th. And it's really cool because in the past, what they did for the Lord of the Rings trilogy is they released just sort of a cut-down soundtrack, 70 minutes of some music from the movies.
Yeah.
Obviously, they had a lot more music. So they went back after the trilogy was done, did complete recordings. Those are the ones I have that are really good. They have every single second of music from the films, and then some stuff that was cut out even. Well, they're just kind of going the complete recording route from the beginning. It's going to be two CDs, pretty much the whole score to the movie. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a couple things missing, but not anything major. And that means we also got the track listing, and that's just fun to look through the track listing and see sort of the beats of the movie.
Yeah.
And kind of get into it. I like that. I mean, you can definitely tell there's going to be, you know, they're going to be giving the right amount of focus to the stuff with the dwarves at the beginning. I like that they're going to be able to really do that scene unabridged at Bag End.
Yeah.
Things like that. And it also confirms sort of the arc of the movie, that definitely the whole climax and sort of adventure of this portion will be the, you know, the trolls under the mountains.
Yeah, so Gollum. They have a track called Riddles in the Dark, which is the chapter in the book where Gollum comes in.
Yep, and that's near the end of the soundtrack. And then after that, I think it'll look like sort of the climax of the film will be them getting away and probably getting to Beorn, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So, which definitely, that would be a cool place to start film two, is them going into the forest and the spiders and all that. I think that would be a good kickoff.
Yeah, I agree. So, I also like how there's just a track called Radagast the Brown, so Sylvester McCoy in the movie gets his own song. I like that.
I like that, too. We're excited for Sylvester McCoy as Radagast, because he was the seventh Doctor on Doctor Who, and one of the best.
Yeah. Sylvester McCoy's awesome.
Yeah.
He should be in more stuff.
And it looks like they're bringing Radagast in a little earlier than maybe in the book for his own scenes, which is great. Yeah. Radagast is an awesome character. And
awesome name.
Yeah. So, anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I think it's cool. I'm very excited to hear this soundtrack. I remember when I was telling my brother, who's also a big fan of the Howard Shore scores, you know, I was like, oh, he's like, when was it coming out? I'm like, well, it's only 3 days before the movie. And we were both like, oh, damn it, because it would have been exciting to hear it. But anyway, it's all good. I'm sure they're still working on it, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Get it perfect, everyone. And they also announced Hobbit tickets are going on sale on Wednesday, November 7th. Now, I just think that's stupid, like setting a pre-sale date for movie tickets. There's really no movie big enough to warrant that.
Yeah.
Even Dark Knight Rises didn't really need it this summer. I mean, it didn't gross as much as Avengers, and they didn't do that for Avengers. But anyway, I digress. The one exciting thing is they confirmed they will be doing, Warner Brothers will be hosting a full Lord of the Rings marathon. They will be doing all three extended editions back-to-back the weekend before Hobbit comes into theaters. So I like that it's on a weekend. You don't have to miss work or school to go see that if you want to do it. So
yeah,
I may try. I've never sat down and watched all 12 hours of Lord of the Rings at once. So this might be the time.
I guess. It's just there's something kind of weird about like watching the Lord of the Rings movies in anticipation of the prequel to the Lord of the Rings movies. I don't know. Like,
I know it's weird.
It's like watching episodes 4, 5, and 6 and then watching episode 1 of Star Wars. It's like, I don't know. It's kind of funky.
Although then you're implying The Hobbit will suck.
Well, it's not equating the quality of the movies. I'm just saying the prequel status.
Right.
Strange.
Yes. So, I'm sure these prequels will be much better. I mean, they would have to do very little to be much better.
Yes.
The fact that they're competently cast and we can tell that going in, that makes them infinitely better than the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah. I think so. The fact that they have Sylvester McCoy is just like, you've already won at that point.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, the other reason I'm happy Halo 4 is coming out now is it'll be a good distraction until The Hobbit, because that's the other thing I'm just unbelievably excited for.
Yeah.
If there was nothing between now and The Hobbit, that would suck, but there's Halo, and that's enough.
Yeah, I agree.
Plenty. We can go to a Halo coma until December 14th, and then come out of our cocoons and go see The Hobbit, and then go back into the Halo 4 cocoon.
Yeah. So, I like how you describe it as a cocoon.
We'll emerge after we beat campaign as beautiful Halo butterflies.
Yeah.
That was the weirdest analogy I have ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just move on. Let's get on to the part of the discussion.
So let's talk about some Halo stuff. Now, before we get into sort of the, you know, hardcore Halo stuff, sort of the peripheral stuff that's going on right now, Sean has seen the entire Forward Unto Dawn miniseries.
Yes, the last episode aired on Friday.
Yes.
It's kind of a weird term for a web series, but...
Yeah. I have not, though. How was it?
It was fucking awesome. Like, okay. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it for you, but it was fucking awesome. And the Master Chief does some really cool stuff in the last episode.
That's great. Now, I know Forward Unto Dawn is a prequel, right?
Yeah, it's set, I think it's 2526, so it's like the year after sort of like the Covenant start invading. Like, the Master Chief's like 15 years old.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, then they actually like do make reference to that, and I really like that. They're not trying to sort of like hide that fact. Because most people are not so obsessed with Halo like me that they would know that the Master Chief was like 15 years old when they
activated. I immediately think of the scene in the Fall of Reach book where he's in school when he hears of the Covenant for the first time.
Harvest Falls. Yeah. So it's like, it's right at the beginning of the Covenant invasion.
Okay.
And then the main character in Forward Unto Dawn is a kid named Lasky, who's going to be one of the main characters in Halo 4, and they sort of tie it into the beginning of Halo 4 in a really cool way. So I definitely, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't watched Forward Unto Dawn yet, I'd definitely watch it before you start Halo 4, because I imagine it's going to have it's going to give you just like a little bit of perspective on one of the main characters in Halo 4. Yeah. I imagine. I haven't played Halo 4, so I don't know how important Lasky is, but they definitely made mention of him, and that's why he stars in the series.
Right. And I guess my question in saying, was it a prequel, is this a good prequel that really enriches your view of the universe?
I think so, especially if you're someone who hasn't read a lot of the Halo novels, and you don't necessarily want to, which I don't begrudge you that. It's kind of...
a lot of time and effort.
Yeah. This is a good little, like, quick, it's about not quite 90 minutes long, so it's almost like a sort of full feature-length movie, and it gets into some background details of the Halo universe. This is a nice little chunk of Halo fiction that's really well done. To me, even though it doesn't technically count, it's the best video game movie there's been, just in terms of how good it is, and then also how faithful it is to the source material.
Yeah. So, makes me sad we're not getting a full Halo movie anytime soon, but...
Yeah, but I mean, one of the cool things about Forward Unto Dawn is that since it's this web series, it's not like this big, you know, multi-million dollar Hollywood project.
They can be true to the
series. Yeah, they can be true to the series, and they get to tell this cool little side story instead of trying to focus on, you know, the stories we've already seen in the games. And I really like that.
I agree. That's cool.
They're able to flesh out the universe in a really cool way.
And if this worked for them and it helps, I mean, there's no reason we won't see this again.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for. I mean, it's getting really good buzz all over the place. Not just me who likes it. So.
I've heard nothing but good things, even from people who had little, like, quibbles with it. I heard nothing but, like, respect for the... you know, sort of audacity and ambition of it.
Yeah, especially, this is, as far as I'm aware, completely unprecedented, something of this scale for a web series. It's really awesome.
Now, tied in with these sorts of discussions in terms of, like, series around Halo, there's obviously Red versus Blue, Rooster Teeth's landmark Machinima series in its 10th season. Now, obviously, we've covered this season before on this podcast. We looked at it at the beginning of the season, we did a check-in at the middle, and we will do a full review of season 10. This podcast is coming out Monday morning. It does not air until Monday night. So we haven't seen it yet. We record these Sunday night, so we're a full 24 hours out. We're very excited for the finale.
Yeah, the season so far has been really, really good.
Oh, absolutely. It's been... if they tie it up right, I think it could very well be their best season ever.
Yeah.
So I want to reserve judgment, because there are other seasons that wrapped up so friggin' well. We'll have to see. But, you know, definitely, just so far on an episode-by-episode basis, I have not enjoyed a season of Red vs. Blue this much before.
Yeah, no, I'm totally there with you.
So, but we will, next week, we will sort of do two reviews in one. We'll do the full Halo 4 review, or at least of the campaign, and probably first impressions of multiplayer, because multiplayer takes a long time to really review, I think.
Yeah.
But we can at least, we will definitely review the Halo 4 campaign in detail with spoilers, all sorts of stuff. We'll probably do a spoiler-free review at the beginning for people who haven't finished it.
Yeah, really get into it.
Yeah, and then really get into it. And then we will also do a spoilery review of Red vs. Blue Season 10. So next week, if you're interested in either of those, try to play, you know, as much of the campaign as you can. Some people are busy, so, you know, if you can't, you can't. You can put it off. But definitely watch the finale to Red vs. Blue, because that's like 10 minutes, and we'll talk about it. And we're excited for both.
Yeah, it's so cool that all this like really cool Halo stuff is coming out around the same time. You've got Forward Unto Dawn, you've got Season 10 of Red vs. Blue, and then Halo 4 all coming out in like this little chunk.
Well, and also the Red vs. Blue season, or Red vs. Blue 10th anniversary box set, 14 discs on Blu-ray, I have that coming later in the week, and if it comes in time, we'll definitely, probably not offer a full review, because that's a lot of content to get through.
Yeah, but we can talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, check out the video quality and see how it looks and sounds and everything. I know they've remixed the first couple seasons in full 5.1 audio. I'm excited to hear how they even did that, because I don't know how you kind of make season one sound better.
Yeah.
But, because that's the charm of it, is
when half the audio is the guy is talking through a phone.
Yeah. Which oddly worked. I mean, I don't know what it was. It's just like it kind of felt right. Not that I say they should go back to that. I like the professional audio now. But anyway. So, Halo 4. The reviews have kind of hit. And I'm happy to say they've been, or see that they have been positive.
Yeah, it's been really, really good. I mean, one of the interesting things about Assassin's Creed 3 was, it got, not that it got bad reviews, and I don't necessarily like to put too much weight into Metacritic type stuff, But it's right now Assassin's Creed 3 is like sitting at an 85 on Metacritic score, and I think Halo 4 is at a 90, or might be an 89. So it's kind of interesting to me that Assassin's Creed 3 did not, even though it was really well received, it did not get quite the bombast one would expect of a full new Assassin's Creed title.
Yeah, Assassin's Creed's at 85, Halo 4 is at 88. And obviously those are, Metacritic's kind of weird in how it ranks all that.
Yeah, especially if you have a score that is not out of 100 or out of 10. If you're doing stars, I always like how it... But, yeah. So Halo 4 has been getting really, really good reviews. There's, like, two middling-ish reviews that I've seen.
Yeah.
And one of them is of suspect quality.
If you want to read a Halo 4 review, if you, you know, just want to read it, I would recommend the IGN one because they kept it free of any spoilers. And it was really nice of them just sort of describing the gameplay, things they liked and didn't like. And
yeah, really especially if you're a fan of the Halo games, because I know the guy, Ryan McCaffrey, is a huge fan of the Halo games. So yeah. That's like, especially that review from that sort of perspective, it's definitely written that way.
Yeah. So it's a good review. And I think he understands how fans like Sean and I like Halo, and he focused on the things I wanted to hear about at least. Yeah. And it made me really psyched because, I mean, let's just talk about the hypes, like things we're excited for in Halo 4. I mean, I'm excited to have a new campaign again. But I almost feel like sometimes that's an afterthought when I think about the game, because I'm so excited about just diving into a whole new multiplayer suite, because that's where I spend most of my time with Halo anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's because, you know, I told you about this last week that I have, since Halo 2, every single time a Halo game has come out, I've beaten the campaign on the day it comes out. Like, that is my day, just playing the Halo campaign. And I'm so, so excited for the Halo 4 campaign, because all the stuff that has come out with 343 Industries about sort of the direction they're taking with the game is so cool, and I think they're taking it in exactly where I wanted them to go with it.
Yes.
So I'm super excited about the campaign and seeing where they take the Chief and Cortana.
I absolutely agree, and again, without spoilers, I don't want to say anything, because we don't really know anything anyway, but it's just the idea of definitely making it more character-focused and intimate is a great... I think that's the only path you could go in at this point.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's...
Yeah, focusing on sort of more on the Chief as a character and less as a vassal for the player to inhabit.
Right.
I like that. I'm getting kind of tired of that in first-person shooter characters at this point, that, like, every single first-person shooter character since Gordon Freeman's, like, has no personality.
Right. And, I mean, it's interesting because almost by accident, the Chief became this person people just loved by the end of Halo 3.
Mm-hmm.
And were very invested in. And the people who stupidly didn't sit to the end of the credits on Halo 3 were very, you know, distraught by his apparent death and those sorts of things. And I think that speaks a lot to, you know, taking that fan reaction and saying, well, now let's really do it consciously and say, what can we do with the Chief? Because if you read some of the fiction, I mean, he's a very compelling character in Fall of Reach.
Yeah, in the Eric Nyland books, Fall of Reach and First Strike, he's a really well-drawn character, and he's really interesting.
He's a very tragic hero in a sense, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, because by the time we meet him in Halo 1, he's pretty much lost everyone and everything he ever cared about.
Yeah, no, seriously.
And
Halo 5 Spartans, and even then, the only one he knows is kind of alive is Linda, and she's not really alive.
No. And I think you can always kind of view Halo 1 in a different light when you think of that, and that to a certain degree, the events on Halo help him sort of just deal through those issues. And like, it's like he has something to distract himself almost, you know?
But, yeah, the giant galactic destroying threat.
Right.
It's like, hey, I can take my mind off all the shit I've been going through, and I can just kill a lot of bitches.
Yes, exactly. So, and I'll say this, the overall thing I've been hearing about Halo 4 on every side, the campaign and the multiplayer and Spartan Ops and all these other things they've thrown in, is that they really took this opportunity to reinvent Halo.
Yeah.
And push it in a totally new direction, and that's exactly what I personally always wanted if they were going to make the game called Halo 4 and push forward, would be to basically treat it as Halo 2.0, rebooting everything. I mean, keeping with the continuity and everything, but really saying this is a chance to make a sort of new series within the series.
Yeah, definitely going in a new direction with the story, then also incorporating more sort of modern shooter aspects into the gameplay without sacrificing what the gameplay is about.
Right.
Which it seems like, based on the reviews, that was one of the things I was most worried about, and a lot of the fan base was kind of worried about, is a lot of the modern shooter elements, like ordnance drops and stuff like that, and having customizable loadouts where you have to unlock the weapons is sort of a tricky thing to do with Halo, but based on all the reviews, it seems like that's been really well executed and does not sort of hurt the Halo formula any.
Right, and that's good, because again, that was the thing I was worried about, because while I enjoy Call of Duty multiplayer, I think it's way too complex. The
There's just, especially since Modern Warfare 2, there's just too much stuff in Call of Duty multiplayer to me.
No, and just to make a loadout and like pick, like, I want to use an AK-47 in this match, you have to go through pages upon pages of menus. And I've always liked that Halo, you just kind of do it and it's instinctual. And I hope they found a way to incorporate that.
Seems so. Especially because they have the map, they have like map and mode specific, like three or so map and mode specific loadouts. So, you know, if you're level one and you go into a match, and you don't have anything other than basically an assault rifle and a magnum, you can still pick whatever, like, the hard light shield and DMR loadout that goes with the map.
Well, it definitely looks like they've done a good job balancing weapons from the beginning and all these other things, because one of the great things about Halo to me is that your skill level is really what dictates things, not what you have in the game.
Yeah, it's an arena shooter. It's like everyone starts on a level playing field, and it's a competitive game, and it's a skill-based game. It's not about how much you've played and all the crap that you've unlocked and getting broken kill streaks and stuff like that. Like,
I mean, if you walked into Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 today and you had never played the game before, you'd be fucked.
You'd just get destroyed game after game after game until you like ground your way up to like level 25 or so. It's like, I can kind of stand a chance against these dudes now.
Yeah. But Halo, and that's why Halo's always been better than that. And I mean, there are match types that, you know I like, because where it evens it out even more, like my favorite match, and we'll talk about this later, is like SWAT, just because it's, you got the one weapon, and it's just you and sort of your instincts.
It's
and
just
I love
you
that.
And your headshots, and that's
yes,
it.
That's it. And I'm super excited for SWAT in Halo 4, because now we've got DMRs and battle rifles. That could shake things up.
Yeah, DMRs, battle rifles, carbine, carbines, some Promethean light rifle. It looks like there's a healthy selection of weapons this time around to fill out sort of the loadout aspect of the game.
Yeah, definitely. So, the one thing we can really offer a concrete review of so far, which is interesting, is the soundtrack of Halo 4, because it came out last week. And before we talk about the music itself, there are two variations. You can buy, obviously you can buy it on CD, which is the standard edition, but I don't know why you would need to do that. Or you can buy...
What's a CD? What are you talking about? You can buy music in some sort of like physical disc thing?
Yeah, and then you have to rip it. You're never going to use that. You just rip it to your computer, and then you listen to it from there.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a middle step. That's what CDs are. Anyway, I know if there's any audiophiles listening, they want to kill us, but, you know, that's how it goes.
Yeah, they can kill us all the way from 1995 if you're still listening to CDs.
Right. I mean, brief tangent, I consider myself an audiophile in some ways. I still don't think you need CDs to do that, because they're still clunky, and they don't necessarily provide the best sound, but, you know, whatever. But yeah, so there's that version, and then, so it's, the base version is 15 tracks, get that on iTunes anywhere else, and then there's also a limited edition you can get on iTunes and everywhere else, but it's not on CD, and that has 6 bonus tracks, which are just remixes. This is the one you got, Sean. Do you think it's worth the extra money?
To me, no, but all the remixes, other with the exception of one, which I can't remember the name of the band, but it's like a heavy metal band, and it's a remix I kind of like. I think it's the last song they remixed. But all the other remixes on that CD are sort of like house music or electronic music, and that's not really my genre.
If you like it, go ahead.
Yeah, if you like it, you know, give a listen to the tracks on iTunes or look them up on YouTube. And if that's your thing, go ahead and do it.
But it's not much money more. It's like
$3. It's like $1, $2 more. So I'm not angry that I didn't get it. I might listen to those tracks every once in a while.
Yeah, I know the price difference on iTunes is $8.99 for the regular CD and $11.99 for the limited. And I'll tell you, $8.99 for the base version, because again, the bonus does not come with actual bonus like pieces of score. It's just remixes.
Yeah.
And obviously, it would be worth it if you got more score, but you're not. But definitely, $8.99 for the 80-minute CD you get, or for the, you know, album you get, is a great deal. That's really good. I mean, most CDs cost way, or albums cost way more than that now digitally. Mm-hmm. So $8.99, great purchase. Because the music for Halo 4, in a word, is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, really good. I was immensely impressed with the score.
I was too, and I think we were on the same page, which is that, not that, you know, we distrusted this new composer, Neil Davidge, because I don't really know his work.
He did a band a while ago, Massive Attack, that was fairly popular. I haven't heard a lot of their music,
but
that's where he's from.
Right, but I was wary, I was a tad wary of the music stuff, not because I distrust that composer, again, didn't know him, but that Martin O'Donnell's music was so instrumental to how we view, I think, the original Halo games.
Yeah, well, and just even like video game music today. That like the score to the first Halo game was huge.
Oh yeah, and they still all hold up beautifully. They're just great compositions. And so to think of Halo without Martin O'Donnell is almost like Halo without the assault rifle is just like...
Yeah, it was like Star Wars without John Williams.
Right. And yet, I think the Neil David score for Halo 4 is every bit as good, just in very, very different ways.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
It's definitely not the same kind of music where Marty O'Donnell, for aside from some of like the Flood or Covenant themes, most of them were very like heavy, bombastic, military-style anthems.
Yeah.
And this... The Neil David's score for Halo 4 is much more...
symphonic.
Yeah, symphonic. It's much more personal. It doesn't deal with really heavy themes, but there's... It's just... It's an amazing score. I think it might be... I haven't, like, had that much time listening to it, but it might be one of my favorite Halo scores. It's...
Oh, absolutely. I think just as a... If you just sit down and listen to these 80 minutes of music as a, you know, as in just a, almost like a symphony, it's a powerful experience on its own. Like, even if it weren't related to Halo, it would be a good album just to own and listen to.
I agree.
And, you know, this is the thing that I think strikes me most about it, is it plays very much like a film score. And I don't know if that's how they've edited it for the album, or if that's sort of how the game is laid out. We'll find that out on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But it's very much a... you know, it plays with, you know, it's not cycling themes and things like that. It's very much pieces of music that are contained and then go on to the next piece, but sort of tell a larger story musically. Yeah. And you could definitely hear this being the 80-minute score to a two-hour film, and probably a really good film, because it sounds pretty fucking intense at times.
Yeah, no, seriously.
Yeah.
He incorporates some sort of electronic elements into some of the scores that really hit hard. I mean, there are some moments that's just like, holy shit, this is... it just makes you imagine what could be going on in the game.
Yeah.
And I like just even... It's an interesting... This is probably the first time I've ever bought a soundtrack to something before I've experienced like the thing it's actually from. And it's an interesting experience trying to listen to it and sort of try to piece together like the thematic elements and how they might tie into the game based on what I know. Like, trying to say, is this... This sounds like it's probably the Promethean like sort of style.
Yeah.
It'll pop up a few times. Like, this is sort of like, the Chief's doing something really cool here. I know that for sure.
Right, and we should say, if you're, you know, worried about spoilers on the soundtrack, the track's listing is totally spoiler-free. You cannot tell a single thing about the story just looking at the track names.
Yeah, they're all like one to max two words.
Yeah, it's like Awakening, Haven, Solace.
Belly of the Beast, that's my favorite one, because it's just like, that's such a cliche.
I know. So, you know, who knows what... obviously they will mean something once you play the game, but before you play the game, they're just cool names that you can relate to the songs.
Yeah.
But, definitely just great. Great fucking score. I think it's got an emotional and a very sort of intensely emotional edge to it that I think Martin O'Donnell... He had definitely had some of that. There are very emotional moments, but this is even more heavy on that.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think you can hear just emotional beats in the music, and I love that, and I love how... You talked about Martin O'Donnell's score always being very bombastic and big and militaristic. This definitely has action pieces to it where you can tell intense stuff is going down.
Yeah.
But there's always an emotional tie-in to it, and I love that. Like, the opening track, Awakening, which is fucking phenomenal and just totally grips you.
Yeah.
Obviously, something big is going on there. There's an attack, there's something. But you're also feeling...
Somebody's waking up.
Yeah.
And you can probably guess who.
Right. But there is an emotional element to it, too. You're definitely feeling like a sense of rebirth, of sort of, you know, reintegrating oneself into the world, all these different sort of emotions that come in when you listen to the music, and then, but with this very intense edge to it. I love that. It's very different for Halo, but it works 100%.
Yeah, I thought it was also very interesting that there's only one time in the track, 117, about halfway through, I picked out, like one old-school Halo motif. Like, yes. That was the only one I picked out, and that was a good decision not to, rely on the old Halo themes, but like some of the music is very reminiscent of it, and that was the only time I really like picked it out. It's like, that's from old Halo stuff.
Yeah, the one I picked out was, it's got the beginning of the piano. It's played on strings this time, but it's the little piano lick from Halo 3, that the dun 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 dun.
Yeah,
they do on strings once. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, actually, it's a powerful moment when it comes in, because it's calm for a second, goes into that, and then goes into like the heaviest part of that track. It's really well written. So that 117 track you're talking about, which is near the end of the soundtrack, that's my favorite track on the album. It just really kind of fills me with emotion when I listen to it. You can tell this is a big moment, both from an action and character standpoint. And to me, it almost feels like the perfect... I mean, it's called 117, so I've just assumed it has something to do with the Chief.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows?
It is a good assumption, right. Probably.
But it definitely, it's a song, when I hear it, it makes me think of the Master Chief, because it kind of embodies a lot of the things that resonate with me about that character, but musically.
Yeah.
Sort of the intensity of it and sort of the commitment and all these other things. It's a great track. It's very sweeping and big and just filled with all sorts of musical styles. Great, great track.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of the cool things about this to me is that it's like, even, I know it's not going to, but even if Halo 4 sucked, I would just be like, I want Halo 5 to come out so I can have another score.
I know.
Because this score was so good. I mean, when I bought it, I was obviously going to listen to it, but I didn't necessarily say to myself, I'm just going to sit down and listen to the entire thing. I just listened to like the first two songs and said, I'm stuck here for 80 minutes now because I can't stop listening to it at this point.
It was the same for me where I was actually, you know, I was going to put it on while doing something else and just maybe listen to a couple tracks, and then Awakening starts and the main theme kicks in. And I was just hooked. And I was like, that's it. That's my night. I'm listening to this.
Yeah.
Actually went out to my Apple TV where we've got a 5.1 setup and listened to it like that with a subwoofer and everything. And it sounded fucking awesome. So, damn good score. What other things do we want to talk about with it?
I just say, I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go into it. But to me, you said your favorite track was 117. And I would have to say, if I had to pin down my favorite, it'd probably be the track 2 Galaxy. That is, it's very similar. It's just like, it's very similar to 117, sort of thematically. It's like 117. It goes a lot of different places. It's not just sort of a traditional, you know, we're repeating the same basic musical motif over and over and over throughout the song. It very much like had a whole just arc to it,
right?
That I thought was very good. And then all the songs, there's several of them that have what I assume are the Forerunner themes. That have like, they've got the really heavy electronic element to it. It also moves into this sort of like soft choir element that's really powerful and really effective. It sort of contrasts this very like hard technological and then this very organic type of music that I've really loved. I have to say, there's this one part in the track, I believe it's called Haven, where the string section comes in that is, it's such an interesting sounding string section to me because it sounds super alien. Like, I don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't know what they did to make it sound like that, but it sounds awesome. And it just like really gives this sense that you're on this sort of, like, alien planet.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of good stuff like that. And I think what you said about 2 Galaxy, where definitely it's a piece of music, it's not repeating like a video game score usually would.
Yeah.
That's the definite thing I want to point out about the Halo 4 soundtrack, is that it is listenable as an 80-minute just piece.
Yeah, totally.
And that's different. And I'm not saying that as a knock against a lot of video game soundtracks, but, you know, for Halo 2 and 3, they would do these, you know, two-disc sets with everything on it, where it's all the cycling music. And I'm glad to have that archive,
yeah,
but it's not really an album you sit down and listen to.
Yeah, no, definitely not, because they, I mean, this is one of the things that'll be interesting once Halo 4 comes out, is that, especially with Halo 3, but the entire Halo series is sort of, to me, done music better than any other video game, especially in, like, this sort of modern era, where they have taken great pains at creating systems that dynamically change how the music tracks play. You know, there'll be a drum beat that comes in based on stuff you do. It'll, like, it always finishes out really nice once you've, like, cleared the area.
To the degree where you don't think about it when
you
play.
Yeah, you don't think about it. It's only, you know, I've watched a lot of interviews with Marty O'Donnell, the composer for the first few Halo games, and just getting a look behind the sort of, like, those systems, it's very interesting. And so those scores, particularly Halo 3, is straight up, this is what you'd be hearing if you played the game, as best as we can replicate it without you actually having played, like, playing the game right now.
Right. Halo 4 is different. It's just, it's the pieces, and I don't know how they'll be mixed in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I hope at some point they come out with, like, sort of that style of soundtrack, too.
Yeah, because
I assume
score.
There's going to be a lot more music in the game than just what's here. Like,
right.
These seem like these are the major pieces that would definitely play over cutscenes and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I agree. I think one day we will probably get a two-disc, you know, Halo 4 complete recordings or something. And I'll definitely buy that because I'll want to have it. But if I were going to sit down and say, I want to listen to Halo 4, this is the album I'd go to. It's a very well-arranged and put-together album. And it's just really cool. And I just want to reinforce how fucking awesome the cover art to Halo 4 is, because it's on the soundtrack too. It's just, it's like the Chief in the middle there in, you know, in kind of a very Master Chief pose where he's got a gun in one hand, he's, you know, down on the ground, and there's just shit falling around him everywhere. It's like things are collapsing and he's in the middle, sort of strong in the middle. It just looks cool.
Yeah, I agree. Especially because we've had this sort of like, either the modern era of video game box art, like, it's just, like, terrible to me. It's always, like, some dude walking towards you. It's like the main character of the dude's walking towards you, and he's got his weapon in his hand, and that's it. Like, that's
pretty
the box art to every single freaking game that comes out nowadays. And the Halo 4 boxer has much more style to it. I like it.
Yeah, it's a piece of art. It's not just kind of a cut from the game or a graphic or something. So anyway, that's our little soundtrack review of Halo 4. You know, over the next 24 hours, if you're really so excited for Halo 4, you can't wait. Listen, that will definitely assuage your excitement.
Yeah, no, it's... I mean, even if you're not that interested in Halo, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast if that's the case.
Right.
But I would still recommend the soundtrack, just based on it's really good.
Yeah, I would actually love to hear this guy score a movie one day. I think that'd be cool to hear him do a sort of action side.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested now to go back and listen to the stuff he did for that band Massive Attack. I've looked into the score, a lot of people really love that band, so I'm now very interested in this Neil David guy. He seems... made one hell of a soundtrack.
Yeah, they definitely... It also just fills me with all sorts of... I mean, I was already excited and kind of confident in Halo 4, but even more confidence that 343 doesn't just know what they're doing, but is very proactive in finding the best people to work on every element of the game.
Yeah.
You know, because music is definitely a place where I feel like they could have cut corners and people would have noticed, but not necessarily gotten up in arms about it. But, I mean, they really went all out, and it's great.
Yeah.
So... excited for that element. So, we'll talk a little bit more about Halo 4 stuff at the end of this podcast, but for now, we'd like to do just some Halo retrospective material. So, just talking about the series as a whole, Sean, sort of what is the origin of your relationship with the Halo franchise?
So, I mean, for me, where it all started was back, I have this really good friend of mine named Rob, who I've probably mentioned in several stories on, if not this podcast, in our past podcasts, and... He got an Xbox way before I did. I got an Xbox around the time Halo 2 came out, and the first game he got for the Xbox was Halo 1, and so one day he's like, hey, do you want to play this game? So the first experience I had with Halo 1, I still remember it pretty well. Like, I remember playing the game, and sort of, because this is the first time I ever played a first-person shooter on a console. I mean, I had an N64 and a Sega Genesis were the only other two gaming systems I'd owned up to that point. So this was totally different. Not a huge fan of GoldenEye. I know a lot of people love that game, but to me, it wasn't the thing I played all the time. So with Halo, it was this really revelatory experience, and it was really amazing, and it sort of sparked my... I would say it's the game that really sparked my interest in video games, where, you know, I had played video games before. I really liked Sonic the Hedgehog. I really liked the Blizzard PC games, and I really liked Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. But Halo, to me, like, this was, like, my new thing. This was... something I was now really passionate about. So then eventually I got an Xbox, I've got Halo 2, stuck with it, we've got Halo 3, ODST, Halo Wars, Halo Reach, the Anniversary.
Love at first sight.
Yeah, I mean, I've read... And not only that, one thing that I've loved about Halo was not just that the gameplay is so tight and so well done, but that also Bungie created this really, really interesting sci-fi universe. And this was also the time when I was really getting into Star Wars, so I also... You know, I've read most of the Halo books. I've kind of gotten behind on the more recent ones that I'm now working through. I have the Halo graphic novel. I have the Halo Uprising comic books that Brian Michael Bendis wrote. You know, I have all the soundtracks. I've watched all the commercials God knows how many times because Halo games have the greatest commercials ever.
Oh, absolutely. They're like the only people who give a shit about commercials anymore.
Yeah. I find the Halo games really, really good just from a game perspective, but then also from a storytelling perspective and a larger universe-building perspective, I think...
they're pretty unparalleled.
Yeah, Halo is basically the next Star Wars for me. Like, it's at the start of that, but to me, I can see Halo becoming that. I can see Halo growing into something that big and have that much sort of expanded universe material. Because like with Star Wars, there is always something going on in Halo. If you're a big fan of it, there's always something new coming out to be excited about.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because with the fan community, you can even go further out in things like Red versus Blue.
Yeah, no. I mean, just it's all the machinima. I mean, Halo basically made machinima a thing, along with Red versus Blue, but then also... You know, Bungie has been so good about supporting that by keeping the, like, gun down feature, adding the theater mode and the forge mode. Bungie was so good at cultivating that community and so much, like, of my memories of sort of going around on the internet in the earlier days before YouTube and stuff like that. A lot of viral videos were, like, the Halo Warthog jump and stuff like that. That were just, like, these really cool moments that you could only get in a game like Halo.
Absolutely. So... my origin with Halo was, I don't know the exact date when I probably, or like year when I first played it, but it was probably 2005, because Halo 2 would have had to have been out.
That'd be a year after Halo 2.
Right. And it was my cousin, Joey, came to Colorado with his family, and he had an Xbox, and he brought it with him. This was his I don't think the 360 was out yet. And, you know, he had Halo 2, and we played that. And, I mean, at the time, I knew nothing about Halo. We just started, you know, playing it together. He said, this is a really fun game. He booted up multiplayer. I think probably the first map I ever played on was Ivory Tower or Colossus. Colossus was the ones I definitely remember from the, kind of that time.
Yeah.
And it just got hooked on the gameplay immediately. It was so much fun. And this was also pre... I mean, Xbox Live existed, obviously.
Yeah.
He didn't have it, and we weren't using it. So it was just, you know, him and my brother and, you know, and I playing it. And it was so much fun. And it was a while before I really was even aware Halo had a campaign and story and all this stuff. It was just the multiplayer aspect was so fun that, you know, we played it with him a couple times when we would visit him or any or stuff. So finally, I was so hooked on the Halo multiplayer stuff. And then we had a friend who moved in across the street named Christian, who also had an Xbox and Halo stuff, and we would play his hit copy of Halo 2 also. And eventually I was so addicted on that stuff, I asked my parents for my 14th birthday for a 360, Xbox 360, and then just Halo 1 and 2. I didn't even own a 360 game, I think, until Halo 3 came out. I mean, I just used it to emulate 1 and 2. And boy, God, I just, like, that was love at first sight. Was like, because there's not only the multiplayer stuff, and I love that, and that's kind of what I got the Xbox for in those games, but obviously on my 14th birthday, and I remember this vividly, the first thing I did was I'm like, I know these have stories, I should start one and play them. And so I sat down and I just remember playing the Pillar of Autumn level for the first time on October 8th, 2006, and just, it's like, it was an eye-opening experience. It's like, I'm kind of like you, where I had really loved a lot of video games before then, but I hadn't really been a big gamer, I guess. I'd had some Nintendo consoles and really loved that. I was more of sort of a handheld person, actually, up until that point.
You were a handheld person. You're like a tiny little person that people carried around in their hands.
No, but I was definitely into Game Boy and Nintendo DS and stuff like that, and the Pokemon games or things like that. But then, man, Halo is definitely what got me more into consoles and made me an Xbox enthusiast. I mean, that is... I actually own a PS3 and Wii. I almost never use them for gaming because Xbox, when I think of games at home, like a console game, I just think of the 360 and Xbox, and that's because of Halo. I mean, when I hold an Xbox controller in my hand, I default to the Halo positions. It's like, I know what I do for Halo. And it's just that's how much I love that. But yeah, definitely, it was like, played through Halo 1, it was awesome. Played through Halo 2, it was awesome. And then spent the time until Halo 3 just playing multiplayer. I did not get Xbox Live until near the time 3 came out. So again, my fondest sort of memories of Halo multiplayer are actually just the months we played Halo 2, just like Thomas and I and our friend Christian and some other people, who were just every day after school, we'd come home, we'd boot up Halo 2 and play it for a couple hours, just exploring the different maps. And that's still, I always kind of have the best nostalgia for the Halo 2 maps, because A, I actually do think they're the best multiplayer maps.
No, hands down, Halo 2 has the best multiplayer maps of like any game I've ever played.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just, it's like an endless well of creativity.
And just like almost every single Halo 2 map is a complete classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just amazing.
It is. I mean, if they released tomorrow a $60 package that was just the Halo 2 maps with their own sort of like Xbox Live running engine, I'd buy that for $60. And it's just to play like basic Halo game types on those again, because they were so much fun.
Yeah.
But man, yeah. So Halo 2 and just those maps, I have so many fond memories of that. Even though Halo 2 now is, you know, my least favorite game in the series campaign-wise, it's still one of my favorites just for all the fun multiplayer memories.
Yeah.
And then I definitely, I guess where I kind of think of as my sort of peak of hype for Halo was probably 3.
Definitely. I think the peak of hype for like almost anything ever was Halo 3. That was
so big.
The
and
marketing campaign for that was ludicrous. It was so huge.
And we'll definitely get into that later, into how it lived up to that 100% and everything. But, I mean, that was so cool. And then, my sort of love of Halo has never diminished, I think. And that's what's so interesting about the series. And it speaks to the series more than anything else.
Yeah.
Is that they've kept it up in a way that when a new Halo game comes out, I'm always sort of at the same level of excitement. Like, when Reach came out, I was probably even more hyped than I had been for 3, because I'd enjoyed 3 so much, and it'd been 3 years. I wanted new Halo. I've convinced my dad, we kept this a secret from my mom, to call me in sick so I could play Halo Reach the day it came out. And it was awesome.
Yeah, I should, like, for me, the sort of that sense of anticipation is unparalleled. Like, I only, for Halo, that's at the max I could possibly be. Like, I haven't felt this way about it, like, anticipating Halo 4. I haven't felt this way about anything since Halo Reach. I mean, the only thing that's come closer to the Mass Effect games. Even then, there's something about the Halo. Mostly because I know with the multiplayer, I'm going to be playing these games.
For years.
Yeah, for the next 2 years.
That's what I love is that Halo... I think this is something we mentioned earlier, is that Sean and I are not huge fans of Call of Duty. I think we were once upon a time, but that...
I have heavy franchise fatigue on Call of Duty at this point.
Because Call of Duty has not even attempted to innovate beyond maybe the Nazi Zombies game type at all since Modern Warfare 1.
Yeah.
It's just they've been doing the exact same thing. At best, they're incremental updates. I mean, when Apple releases a new iPad, they put more new things in than a new Call of Duty. I mean, it's just at this point, Call of Duty is just Call of Duty. But every time a new Halo comes out, it feels like it is the absolute cutting edge for gaming at that moment. Because they've really worked hard to say, what's the best this game can be right now? And what are the things we can do to really make the fans feel like they got their money's worth and their time's worth? I mean, it's so funny because we've always paid more than the sort of standard price for a Halo game. Like Legendary Halo 3, Limited Halo Reach. And I'm always happy to do it because even if it came with nothing but the game... A game like Halo 3 would be worth $150.
Yeah.
Because you play it, you could play it every day for years and years. And I did. I mean, Halo Reach is the default game in my Xbox at all times since it came out.
Yeah.
Because if I just want to sit down and just play a game, and that's just what I want to do, I'm not sitting down to like play a story or something like that, I'll just put in Reach. That's my thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's been since Halo 2 for me. It's just like, whatever... If I just want to play a video game, I'm going to play whatever the newest Halo is.
And they endlessly evolve while they're still out. That's what's so crazy, especially since Reach and the Forge world and everything, that you can play Reach every day and have a new map every day if you want to.
Yeah.
And they make it really easy to access those things. It's nuts. But we'll get into those later. So some of those more in depth
when
we get to talking maybe about Reach. So we wanted to go game by game a little bit and just talk about our general thoughts. I think we've probably done some of this before, but we probably haven't gone into detail on things like the story and how we felt about different character beats and things. And I think because Halo 4 is going to be a little more focused on that, maybe that's where we should take it.
Sure.
And some things like that. So Halo 1, again, we'll really just focus on campaign elements here, I think, for these games. But definitely Halo 1. We both think Halo 1 is just an absolute classic, right?
Yeah, completely. It's so hard for me to sort of, like, rank the Halo games, but for the longest time, Combat Evolved has been my favorite campaign. One of my favorite campaigns of any game, any, especially first-person shooters. I think that it's got some sort of pitfalls it runs into in the last few levels where you're running backwards through the game, but I think they add enough in with the introduction of the Flood, and you move through those spaces in a much different way that it's not a big deal to me, but I can understand the complaints.
Well, it's so weird for me because, again, I've been playing this for 7 years now, Halo 1, and I've probably played it 7 or 8 or 9 times. And so while I recognize that things like that are technically pitfalls and failings of the game, I can't dock it because that's just the game to me, and I love it so damn much.
I still love those levels. I mean, two betrayals where you're going back through that, like the assault on the control room level.
Brilliant
is one
level.
Of my favorite. It ends with like the biggest, most bombastic encounter in a Halo game there is, where you enter this canyon. You can have like any weapon you want at this point. They have this big stockpile of weapons. It's at the end of two betrayals. You go into this canyon. At the other end of the canyon, there's a Covenant position that's completely entrenched. They've got force fields all over the place. They've got a bunch of turrets. There's like 5 invisible elites. There's 2 hunters. There's 2 wraiths. There's a general elite, and there's just a bunch of other elites. And you have to go take a Banshee from that position. That is my favorite encounter in a Halo game, because it is, you are just...
It's so hard.
It's so fucking hard. It is the hard, it's, okay, it's not the hardest if you talk about some of the stuff in Halo 2, particularly on Legendary, but this is the most fair of the very difficult moments in Halo games to me, where it's just, you have this encounter, you can approach it any way you want, there's side passages you can take, you can use the Ghost, you can use any weapon there, you can get rocket launcher, sniper rifle, shotgun, pistol, assault rifle, you name it, you have it. But there are a shit ton of enemies that you need to kill, and you are probably fucked. Like, every time I don't think I've ever done a run-through of the Halo campaigns on Heroic or Legendary where I have not died at that encounter.
Right.
That encounter always fucks me the first time, no matter how many times I play it.
Well, I think what you're talking about is all the ways you can, go into that place and how many ways you can approach it. That's what I love about Halo Combat Evolved, and what keeps me playing it over and over is every time I play it, I feel like I'm playing it so differently that it's a new experience.
Yeah.
It's such a... And I don't think that's even... I don't even know that that's what it was intended. It's just, it feels so open in that the way the game is laid out, there's so much creativity in your strategy, and that's one of the major innovations it made. But it's just, it's not like most shooters where, you know, if you play Call of Duty, there's really one way to do everything in Call of Duty.
Yeah, you're moving down a pretty linear, narrow corridor, and there are going to be a bunch of dudes shooting at you, but they're all basically the same dudes shooting at you. You just have to duck behind cover, pop up, shoot them, duck, pop up, shoot them.
Right.
With Halo, there's so many different factors that go into the more creative encounters with
right.
What weapons you bring in, because Halo sort of popularized that concept. You only have two weapons because you don't have a keyboard, so you can't select, like, 10 weapons really easily. So you just have to switch between the two. So the weapon selection is really important. And then you also have all the vehicles that you have to take into account. And then the weapon, or then the enemy types are so varied and so well done. The AI in all the Halo games is the best AI in first-person shooters because the different enemy types, the core ones, you know, the Jackals, the Elites, and the Grunts, interact so well together. You know, you kill an Elite and the Grunts all scatter. I love that. Every single time that happens, I love that.
Because I love it too.
You have these sort of like reliable AI patterns that you can take advantage of intelligently in any encounter, but then the AI will always find a way to surprise you. Like that Grunt might stop running a little bit shorter than you expect, and he will throw a grenade at you and you will die. Like, the AI yeah. will always find a way to surprise you in a Halo game. Like, that hunter might be a bit more tenacious than you were expecting and follow you down a very narrow corridor where you are just fucked now.
I know, I love stuff like that. Like, that's one of the, Halo's one of the few games where you can have fun when you're dying.
Yeah, you know? Where it's just like, something you can get, especially Halo 1, where, the grenades in particular in Halo 1 are so ludicrously overpowered, the explosions are yeah. so huge, and then it's also, like, grenades that explode will set off other grenades on the ground. But there have been situations where I've blown up an entire room, including myself, without even realizing it, because of all the dead bodies with grenades strewn about, and it's just like, everything goes up in, like, blue flame.
I love that, and I love it especially in Halo Anniversary, because they have an extra skull where grunts will explode when they die.
Yeah.
And I love playing Halo like that, because without even meaning it, you can set off just fucking nuclear bombs of yeah. grenades.
Because that grunt will blow up, that will blow up another grunt who also has some grenades that will then blow up, that will blow up other grunts. This is...
If there's any Marines in there, they've got all grunts.
Yeah, and they're all dead immediately. Yeah.
There's always been this weird dichotomy between the really good AI of the enemies and the kind of shitty AI on the Marines.
Yeah, it's this weird thing where the Marines always seem like, I don't know if this is just like my perspective on it or what, but it seems like the AI on your friendly people have gotten worse throughout the Halo games, whereas the AI on the enemies has gotten better. But they added nice features in the Halo games that allow you to compensate for the now weirdly annoying friendly AI, where it's like you can switch weapons with them, you can get them the fuck out of the Warthog a lot easier.
Yeah.
It's like, for some reason, the Marines just seem to get dumber and dumber.
Yeah, who knows? But definitely that creativity to Halo, where it just, Halo 1 definitely feels like a different game when you play it, and all the ways you can approach it. That's why it and Reach, which I think very much shares that same trait, are my two favorite just to play, like, gameplay-wise campaigns. I definitely feel like they have that same trait to them, where every time you approach a level, it's like, you have to sit down and think, how am I going to do this? You try it, and if you fail, you're going to have fun failing.
Yeah.
So...
That's one of the great things about what Halo can do in a campaign is that they have this sort of combat puzzle.
Right.
That all those different elements of what you choose to bring along with you and what the enemy is going to do is different every single time you play through. So it always feels fresh, and you can. It's kind of stupid to say this, but it's like a sort of a thinking man shooter, especially when you play on the harder difficulties where you have you have to stop and take in consideration what the fuck you're doing, or you're just going to die.
Yeah. I mean, here's a great example of that story. This is from Halo 3, but I think I can say it now, because it's a pretty universal Halo situation. I was playing Halo 3 this morning with my little brother, Thomas, and we were playing on co-op, as we usually do. I mean, that's the other thing. Halo has great co-op.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later. But we were playing it. He was in the Warthog driving. I was shooting. He's a terrible driver in Halo. And so we're going up to this. It was on the Savo Highway level, and we're going up to this, you know, a big part where basically the brutes have overtaken. There's all these crashed cars and things.
Yeah.
And I think the key to approaching it is that there's a big, you know, there's a lot of enemies. You can't just go in and expect to kill them all. You can't do it. So the key to me is that there's a big truck crashed in the middle of that thing.
Yeah.
I would get behind the truck because then the turrets can't hit you. Now there are other enemies behind you, but you can fix, you know, can get rid of them because that's a small chunk. You use the truck as cover. Then you get back out and maybe figure out the turret situation. Well, Thomas was, like, mad at me for suggesting that, and he kept wanting to, like, just run around and just kind of jump out in the middle near the turrets, start fighting. I would get killed immediately, because I'm still in the turret trying to shoot. I get killed immediately. He'd have a couple more seconds, and then everything would explode. So that's kind of how he would approach it. And then I finally said, Thomas, just do what I'm saying. Just go behind the truck, get out, and like jump behind the Warthog while they start shooting at you. When they run out of ammo, we'll run out. Kill them, then we'll take care of the turrets. It worked immediately. I think that's a great example of how that's how you kind of have to approach hard Halo situations.
Yeah, you have to stop and think about it. But talking about the grenades reminded me of one of my favorite experiences in playing a Halo campaign, specifically on co-op, is one time, I think we were doing assault on the control room, and I was playing co-op with one of my friends, and we're kind of getting bored, and for some reason, I'm really sadistic when I play Halo 1 co-op. Like, all the other games, I will play with you, I will be totally reliable, I will help you out, and we're playing the game, we're going to finish it. Halo 1, for whatever reason, I'm not like that. Halo 1, I will dick you over, and since that game is the oldest one and I play it the most, I know so many ways to dick over people in co-op, but that's beside the point. So, eventually, every time you play co-op with me in Halo 1, and then also my friend is an asshole. The friend I was playing with, but it was Kurt.
Kurt is an asshole.
Knows he's an asshole. I'm an asshole too. So we'd end up just killing each other a bunch, and we got to this point where in Assault on the Control Room, you know, you go through a bunch of those sort of interior areas, and there are several points where you go into an elevator, and when the elevator going up, we were killing each other. We were dicking around at the elevator because, you know, if you spawn when the elevator's falling, you get killed by the fall damage. Then at one point, we sort of, like, did this weird thing where, like, I spawned. I think it was either me or Kurt. One of us, we killed each other. We were fucking around at the elevator. One of us spawned under the elevator and fell down to the empty elevator shaft to the bottom and died. And then, but we also had a bunch of grenades. And that sort of, like, got this wheel spinning in our heads. We're like, we're going to start playing a different game now where we would just jump into the elevator shaft, die, we'd get as many grenades as we could, and just keep on doing that over and over and over and over again. And then eventually, we're like, okay, we've got it, this is ready, it's like this is the absolute last grenade we could find without moving past an area where that would, like, disload all that stuff. And it's like, let's light this motherfucker up, threw a grenade down, and it was the most glorious thing ever, where you just have this rain of dead Master Chiefs just shoot up through the elevator shaft from the massive explosion, and then like 50 Master Chief bodies just like slowly start raining down from the ceiling. I wish I had some sort of like capture equipment at the time, because it was so hilarious. It's so hard to explain just how hilarious it was, because we put such a stupid amount of effort into doing that, and it had this really weirdly gratifying payoff because of the ragdoll physics, where they all fall in Halo 1 the exact same way, and they have the animation where he's just like falling, spinning his arms, just seeing like 50 Master Chief bodies just slowly falling down from the ceiling doing that. It was hilarious.
That's awesome.
I also have to say, thinking about ways that you can fuck over other people, specifically on that level, when you're playing co-op, this is great. This is my favorite thing to do in Halo 1 on co-op. When you're in that level, or it's like Mirror, Two Betrayals, where you can get the Banshee, if you kill your AI, or if you kill your human partner while you're in the Banshee, you can fly around, and it'll say, you know, you have to kill most of the enemies around the area too for this to work. And the thing will say, your like co-op partner can't respawn, you're moving too fast. And so if you just bump into the wall while you're flying really high, they'll spawn right next to the wall and fall to their death. I've probably spent like 10 minutes just doing that to Kurt at one point.
You've spent like half an hour doing that to me.
Yeah, it's like I said, I don't know what it is about Halo 1 co-op. I just fuck over whoever I'm with.
There's definitely a kind of fun freewheeling quality to it.
Yeah.
So, my favorite Halo 1 kind of weird glitchy story is on the library where Thomas and I were playing it on co-op. We got near the end of the level, and one thing I should say about Halo 1 co-op is there's no saving for co-op, so you have to do the whole level in one sitting, and the library is a long motherfucker.
Yeah.
And there are those points in the library where there's these big, like, ditches. Well, not ditches, but, like, chasms, you know, and you can fall down them and die.
Yeah, they usually have, like, glass over them, but you can break the glass and then you're fucked.
Well, I fell into one once and lived. And then Thomas died and spawned down next to me. And it turns out that when that happened, we got a checkpoint. So we were just stuck in this bottomless pit at the bottom, and it was terrible. So we were like so mad because we were near the end of the library, and we had to do the whole thing over because of that stupid. I've never been able to recreate that. I always try it now. But I make sure I'm like, Thomas, go stay alive, you know.
Yeah, that's, that reminds me. Another thing, I was playing with Kurt again. Like, Kurt and I played Halo 1 co-op all the fucking time. One time on Two Betrayals, I did a similar thing where you can get a Banshee into the, like, sort of the big control room that has the big Halo hologram at the beginning of Two Betrayals, where the Guilty Spark betrays you. And I got, there's like, you can go down, it's like this big ditch, like dish that goes really deep down into. But if you have a Banshee, you can get down there, obviously, and like avoid the fall damage. And Kurt died, and there's like this little area where it like goes straight down, then like sort of curves in, and there's like this sort of like circle pit that goes down a few more feet. And then I crashed and spawned Kurt down there and flew away, and he couldn't get out. He was sort of like trapped down there.
Nice.
So many great moments of just fucking over people in Halo 1.
Well, I think we've talked about the gameplay enough. What about sort of the story and characters of Halo 1? What strikes you about Halo 1 and how it tells its story?
Halo 1, out of all the Halo games, is definitely the most sparse in the storytelling.
Right.
Because it's, I mean, at that point in time, lots of video games, particularly first-person shooters, you know, you had a bunch of RPGs, but first-person shooters would not particularly tell really a story. You know, Half-Life 1 doesn't really have a story. It's a really immersive game, but it doesn't have, like, a plot, per se, other than to get the fuck out and then stop the alien invasion. Where Halo 1 has characters, it has a plot, it has, you know, cutscenes, it's really well voice acted, and something I recently replayed, the Anniversary Edition, something kind of struck me, is that the writing's actually pretty good.
It is.
It's easy to gloss over that, and it's very cheesy writing most of the time. It's like the main writer for the games all the way up. I think he's 1, 2, 3 in ODST. I'm not sure about Reach. Is Joseph Staten, who has this very sort of like quirky sense of humor that you can really see in a lot of moments in Halo 1. You know, like when the Master Chief will teleport and he's upside down and then he'll hit the floor. It's like those kind of like really cheesy moments. But the first cutscene in Halo 1 where you start it up is a really, really good cutscene.
It's great, yeah.
It immediately sort of, like, you get the sense of what's going on, even if, you know, obviously the first time you play it, you're not going to know the particulars. And one really interesting thing about it is that it doesn't sort of explain the Covenant almost at all. Like, you're just, you have, like, there's a mention of Reach, you have no idea what Reach is. The Fall of Reach novel came out with the game, but I didn't read it when I played it. Most people didn't read it when they played Halo 1, and so you have no idea what Reach is. They make mention of it. There's a lot of little, like, tiny asides where Captain Keyes says we need to initiate the Cold Protocol. And it's like, and you don't know what that is. And then later you find out it's, you have to, like, wipe your navigational data banks and, like, destroy your AIs, or else the Covenant can get them and find Earth. And there's all these, like, cool little moments that they can build on later. But the game just throws you straight into it. You're just, you are on the Pillar of Autumn, you have just jumped from Reach, you've heard that, you have been followed by Covenant, and you found this big fucking ring, and then you go. That's the setup.
And that's what I love about the story in Halo 1 is, yes, it's sparse, but it feels so rich when you're playing it. And I think this is the main narrative innovation Halo 1 made to sort of first-person shooters and console games, is telling its story just through gameplay. And that you play these 9 levels, and you do feel like you've been on a big adventure that meant something.
Yeah.
Like, this was a big event, and you feel like you can cumulatively say that a lot of things happened, and a lot of stuff was accomplished. And it does it mostly without cutscenes. It's just, you're always getting cool story stuff while you're playing the game.
Yeah, and I like how they're only, since Halo has this sort of very traditional level structure to the campaigns, like all the games have had that, you only get the cutscene at the very beginning and end of a level. So your gameplay isn't really interrupted, and by the time you get to the end of the level, it's like you're really looking forward to that cutscene because you need a rest, and you're really interested in like where the story is going to go. And they always use the cutscenes well.
Yeah.
The cutscenes are not too long, and they're always well done. The dialogue is well written. They're very well voice acted, and you're just kind of like, you know, you want to see what is this Guilty Spark guy about? Like,
right.
Where the fuck did this flying ball come from?
Well, I think the other thing that's so interesting is that, you know, in Halo, they've always found, because of how they arc the stories and things, the actual gameplay, it doesn't feel like it doesn't fit the narrative when you have these big missions to go on and things in the levels. Everything you do in Halo feels like it fits the story very well.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing I'd want to sit down and maybe read in like a book. But
which they did have a book.
It's
terrible. Do not read Halo the Flood. If you're trying to get into Halo novels, don't do it.
No, it's just
skip it.
It's basically a walkthrough of Halo 1.
It's Awful book.
But I'm just saying, it's like, you know, the Halo level, where basically the Halo level is sort of a fetch quest for Marines. You're going around Halo fighting the Marines, but in the context of what's happening in that story, you'd have to do that. There's no other. Yeah. That's what you would do as the Master Chief.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. There's nothing that feels too convoluted. Even in later games, when it's stuff like, you know, you have to hit three buttons, it's like, well, those buttons do need to be pressed. I mean, yeah, come on.
We need to lower the shield so we can go fuck up the Prophet of Truth. Like, absolutely. We need to do this.
And then that means when you get to, that's what I was trying to say, is when you get to the cutscene and you've done these things, it feels like we earned it. Like when in Halo 3, for instance, when you get, you know, the big fucking anti-air gun down so they can come attack, that happens because you did something awesome.
Yeah.
So, it's cool. But anyway, story's really good, if sparse, but it's exactly what I think this game needs.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's got some of the more notable, just like the 343 Guilty Spark level, where you're first introduced into the Flood. Where the game sort of, like, takes this turn where you find out what the rings are about. You're sort of, like, now rewarded for your efforts throughout the first half of the game, and you're just set on sort of the second half is all about, like, stopping the ring from getting set off so not everybody dies, and then blowing up the ring. And that level, 343 Guilty Spark, is such a good just narrative level. Yeah. For the first half of the level, there's, like, a handful of Covenant enemies that you fight, but for the most part, you walk through the jungle, you find the big complex, and you make your way through the complex, and it's the only time you have a cutscene in the middle of the level is when you get to the bottom of that complex and you find the Marine helmet with the little, like, video chip in it, and you watch the video and you find out...
That's still one of the best cutscenes in the whole Halo series.
I agree. That whole level, to me, even though it's not necessarily my favorite to play from a gameplay perspective, it's my favorite from, like, a narrative perspective in that game, because it's really well-paced. You have this... It's really creepy, where Halo had not been creepy up to that point.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going on, and then, like, once you find out there's these weird things, and you don't have no idea what the Flood are at this point, because this is the first time you're introduced to them, and you just, like, they are coming out of everywhere. You don't have Cortana with you for the first time in the entire game, so Chief is completely alone, and all these zombie things are coming at you, and then, like, the objective comes up, and it's just, like, escape!
Yeah.
Exclamation point. You're like, I am listening to the objective. I am getting the fuck out of this place.
That level still unsettles me to a certain degree, even though I know what's coming, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
It does a great job. And again, it's putting you in that situation where it's like, it actually pulls sort of the creativity rug out from under you, because now it's just survive, get out, run.
Yeah, you know? The Flood gets a really bad rap amongst Halo fans, but I like the Flood the most in Halo 1. I think they've done the best in Halo 1.
I agree.
Like, Halo 3 had some potential that they didn't really... Like, they went in a really good direction with the Flood, but they didn't quite execute on it. In Halo 1, I really like fighting the Flood. I think it's a really good change of pace. I even like the library. Like, I am, like, it's just this test of endurance where you are just put into this place and you have to get the fuck to the end of it. And there are a lot of guys that do not want you to get to the end of it.
I know. I like the library, too. It's very intense, and it has the desired effect, I think, which is to kind of fuck with you.
Yeah, I think it could have used a more slightly inspired art direction, because it's very samey for most of the level, but I think...
They spruced it up a lot in Anniversary.
Yeah, they did a very good job with it in Anniversary, but yeah, it exposed why the Flood are kind of, even though they're not as interesting necessarily as the Covenant, they're still really fun to fight, because they have, like, these three core enemy types with the infection forms, the carrier forms, and the combat forms that all work really well together, where you can't just ignore the infection forms the entire time, because if your shield gets dropped, you're fucked. And if you're playing Legendary, those carrier forms, when they blow up, they will kill you every single time. That's why you, on Library, you always need a shotgun and you need a pistol.
Oh, because
you need that pistol just to drop those motherfuckers from a distance, because if they blow up, they will kill you every single time.
Absolutely. So... Yeah, and what about sort of the characters in this game? This is obviously not a character-heavy game, but I think it introduces a lot of personalities that became quickly endearing.
Yeah, you've got the core ones are basically, you've just got Chief, Cortana, Captain Keyes, and Guilty Spark are basically all the characters in the game. And then Foehammer is another sort of character. She pops up now and then.
And Johnson's sort of the seeds of a character there.
He wasn't even a named character. He's not... Like, he's...
But he has that great moment at the beginning.
Yeah, at the beginning, he gives a speech, is sort of the...
You want to give the speech?
I don't have the entire... There's four different speeches for all the different...
You once had the legendary one memorized, so...
I have so many Halo quotes that are... I mean, I think the legendary one is the one where he says, I don't care if it's God's own anti-son-of-a-bitch machine or a giant hula hoop, we will not let them have it.
Yeah.
I think that's that one. That's all the first cutscene in Halo, awesome, because that's the only time I think in Halo 1, other than the legendary ending, where Johnson's like in a cutscene, and he's he's also in the 343 Guilty Spark cutscene, but it's like, and he's not Johnson at that point, but it's David Scully playing, you know, the Black Sergeant guy. And
yeah.
He pops up now and then in the gameplay, but he's not like a main named character, and he's just sort of like, he can just be in a group of Marines in a few spots.
Yeah. But definitely, I mean, there are some actually big emotional moments with the characters they build up, because Keyes and Foehammer both die, and it hits you when that happens. Yeah. And Foehammer, especially, because you don't ever see Foehammer, you just hear her.
Yeah, you just hear her, and you always see the Pelican, then.
And then when it doesn't come at the end, it's like, this sucks.
Yeah, this is just...
this is too bad.
Bye, Foehammer. I really liked you.
Yeah. And again, Captain Keyes is definitely a character who actually is so well done that his legacy kind of ripples throughout the trilogy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just always really interesting to think that Captain Keyes is only really in Halo. I mean, he pops up at the very end of Halo Reach, but he's really only in Halo 1. Like, because he dies at the end of Halo 1. And it's because he's such a prominent character to me, even though he's not in Halo 1 that much.
Right.
In, like, the beginning, he's in Truth and Reconciliation, and then he's in the 343 Guilty Spark stuff, and then he's turned into a giant ball of flood stuff.
And you rip his face out.
Yeah, and then you punch him in the face and pull out his neural implants. But yeah, it's, like, it's so interesting to me that Keyes is, like, when you meet him in Reach, it's like, yeah, you're fucking Keyes. You're a really important guy.
I mean, that's
I missed you, man.
That's the emotional hook of the end of Reach to me, is that moment when you're like, I see the importance of what I'm doing here.
Yeah,
you know,
you back in the Pillar of Autumn, it's like, man, I have missed you, Keyes. You are a cool guy.
Yeah,
I
can't wait for the Keyes spinoff game.
Yeah,
just kidding, but definitely Keyes, good character. And, I mean, definitely, you know, your core duo there is Chief and Cortana. And at this point, Chief is really just a vessel for the player, and Cortana is just the voice that tells you where to go. Mm-hmm. But even then, I think it transcends that a little
bit. Yeah, they develop a sort of weird relationship over the course of the game where I think... I mean, actually, they kind of have it at the very beginning where it's like she says about, like, did you have a good rest? And it's like, no, thanks to your driving. Yes. Like, right from the start, they have this nice little sort of, like, quippy relationship with each other.
I like that they ground all emotions out of the Chief except sarcasm.
Yeah, and it's only with Cortana. It's, like, right. Kind of what builds their relationship. And it's weird how that relationship sort of becomes the heart of Halo 2, Halo 3, and then I'm assuming Halo 4 from everything I've heard.
Yeah.
From the direction they're going in.
Heart of Halo Reach to a degree, too.
Like, the Chief and Cortana relationship is sort of what drives the story, and especially, like, the character moments are about the Chief and Cortana.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, you cannot give enough credit to Jen Taylor.
Oh, yeah, she's
Cortana.
Great.
I mean, she's great from the beginning, and she just gets better and better throughout the series.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, it's like, when you play... That's when I think of Halo 1, I basically think of sort of the big grassy environments on Halo, and I think of Jen Taylor's voice in my ear telling me where to go. Yeah. That's Halo.
Keep your head down. There's two of us in here now, remember?
Yep. So, anything else to say about Halo 1?
I think we didn't talk enough about Guilty Spark, because to me, I love that guy.
Oh, of course, he's
Tim DiDabo as Guilty Spark is awesome. He's so great because you don't know quite how crazy he is in all the Halo games. Like, you don't know, is Spark, like, sort of, like, letting on something more? You know, there are a lot of great moments where he's, like, you're on the Pillar of Autumn, and he's looking through all the archives, and he's like... an archive of all our lost time, human history. Is it fascinating? And you sort of get this sense that it's like there's this connection between who made Guilty Spark and the humans, and you don't quite understand. It's like, is Guilty Spark just completely insane? Like, what is going on here? And I like how you never really know how crazy is Guilty Spark. Like, how rampant has he become by the time you find him in Halo 1?
Right. But he's fun, and I like that they bring him back in 3 and have a lot of fun with him.
Yeah.
There, too. That fucker kills Johnson.
Yeah, and you blow his ass up.
You do. You blow him up good. So, that's Halo 1. Now, I was not around for the launch of Halo 2. You were. What was the Halo 2 launch like?
I mean, it was huge. I mean, it wasn't as big as Halo 3, but it was very, very heavily anticipated. I got the limited collector's edition for Halo 2, which the box for it is all fucked up now, but it was huge. Like, it was a big deal when that came out. That was one of the biggest video game launches that I, like, one of the first really big ones that I was there for, that I got it on day one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, again, talking about campaign, I mean, I guess we should quickly mention that Halo 2 is where Halo as a multiplayer suite really comes into its own.
Yeah, with
Xbox Live.
Yeah, with Halo 1, you didn't have Xbox Live, and I have really fond memories of playing LAN parties on Halo 1, but it was very restricted. Like, you had to lug your Xbox and the TV over to someone's house, and that was not the easiest thing to do in the world.
No. So, I mean, I think we've talked about Halo multiplayer so much, there's not much we can say. But Halo 2 has phenomenal maps, great game types, and it still holds up if you just go play with some friends.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, the multiplayer maps in Halo 2 are amazing.
Each one could be their own game. I mean, yeah. I think
there are a very handful of ones that I'm not particularly fond of. Like, I don't like Colossus that much because I think it's unbalanced.
I get that Colossus is unbalanced, but I still kind of love it because it's such a creatively designed map. And
I think Colossus
so...
is really good for like custom games, but there's like that fucking sniper that is bullshit because Halo 2...
I get that. It's just a fun map to just be in there and look around. And like,
I have to say, there are two big foibles with Halo 2 multiplayer that I always feel like I need to mention because I love Halo 2 multiplayer. Halo 2 multiplayer is great. Don't get me wrong. But there are two critical flaws with it that got fixed in Halo 3 that I was very glad when I found out they got fixed in Halo 3. The first was the SMG. The SMG was a terrible spawn weapon. It did not highlight what made Halo good. It didn't, because you couldn't kill almost anyone with the SMG. You didn't get to rely on, like, you know, you didn't have a lot of strategy with the SMG. You had to get a dual-wield SMGs really quickly, or you had to go find a better weapon like a battle rifle. And then also the battle rifle is not quite the best spawn weapon for a lot of maps because it's just too powerful and it's got too much range. So the SMG was a terrible spawn weapon. Then also, when you picked up a power weapon in Halo 2, it did never respawn, and that is what broke Colossus, because there was one power weapon, there was the fucking sniper rifle at the top of that tower, and if the other team got that sniper rifle and hit with it and took you guys out, you were fucked. Because if he never dropped the sniper rifle, even if you ran out of ammo, the sniper rifle would never come back. It was bullshit.
Yep, but man, a lot of good Halo 2 multiplayer memories, but let's just talk about the campaign.
Okay.
From a gameplay standpoint, I guess I'll say with Halo 2, I like Halo 2 a lot. I have much more trouble replaying it than I do the other ones. Like, I can replay the other ones to death. Halo 2, like, I tried to replay it recently, and I had to kind of move on to Halo 3, because it felt like such a grind to me, and I think...
Yeah.
I guess part of it, again, is the SMG is a terrible spawn weapon in campaign also, and I mean, that's not a huge deal. It's just,
yeah, you get new weapons pretty quickly, but right, the SMG is not the assault rifle.
But even then, it's a lot of Halo 2 feels drawn out and poorly paced, and I think it doesn't do what I said Halo 1 and the other games do in terms of everything you do feeling like it has a lot of weight. I think a lot of Halo 2 feels padded in the gameplay.
I can see that, yeah.
Where you're just kind of moving from one area to another, like especially when you land on the new Halo. There's a lot in that section. Like, I think Halo 2 has a phenomenal beginning and end. But then there are parts that have, like the first Arbiter level where you meet the Flood for the first time in that game. And you're on that fucking elevator. And this is the part I hate most in any Halo game, is that fucking elevator in the fourth level where you're just going down and there's nothing you can do and you're just waiting for about 20 minutes fighting Flood over and over and over.
Long.
And, I mean, a lot of the Arbiter levels are actually kind of long grinds.
Yeah, the
like
Arbiter
that.
Levels to me are the big pitfall for Halo 2's campaign because there are, especially, like, Halo 2 is the one where I have the hardest time remembering campaign level names.
I know.
It's usually the one I have played the least out of all the campaigns, but it's like, there's that, and I even have time just like remembering specific details of a lot of the later Arbiter levels. Like, there's the whole section where he goes to the Sentinel Factory. There's like three levels where he's at the Sentinel Factory.
I completely forget.
Remember it. I just like, he spends the entire time fighting fucking Sentinels, which is not an interesting encounter. Like, there's the big Sentinel thing with like the two big arms.
I hate those.
Fight like five times.
I don't remember that part. I mean, now I remember it because you said it, but man, it's an annoying part.
Yeah, but you don't, it's really hard to like remember it. Every time I play Halo 2, I'm like, oh yeah, this happens to this game. This is like the next 3 hours of this game, or me doing whatever I'm doing over here.
Right. The only Arbiter part I really remember is the snow levels, where he's in the snowy area. And it's not... It's probably my favorite part of his campaign, but it's not great.
I think his last two levels are the best Arbiter levels.
Because he gets the end of the game.
Yeah, once the Covenant sort of splits up, after like the Arbiter levels after that are kind of fun.
Yeah.
But they're still not. Because you're mostly fighting brutes, which are not the best enemy.
Right. I mean, Halo 2, I want to say, because I think we're going to sound a little negative on this, but, I mean, Halo 2 is still Halo. It's still a lot of fun. Good game. Worth the every cent. You know, all those things. But
it's easily the weakest campaign.
Easily.
By far.
By far. I mean, there's just so many things we praised about Halo 1, I think, get very muddled here. And part of that is, again, I don't think that same sense of creative spontaneity is there. I think a lot of it feels more like a grind and kind of sluggish, mm-hmm. and it doesn't kind of have the life or verve to it. It's a very beautiful game.
Yeah, I mean, Halo 2, like, pushed the Xbox One to its absolute limit. Like, yeah. It seems like what Halo 4 is doing for the Xbox 360 is what Halo 2 did for the original Xbox, where it's right. like, I did not know that this machine could put out graphic quality of this level,
yeah.
because it is really good looking.
It's great. I mean, there's a lot of creative environments, obviously, because when you go over to multiplayer, which is, you know, nigh flawless, except for the two little things you pointed
yeah.
out, it's all about those things that the campaign does so well. But I think the actual layout of gameplay in the campaign is messy.
Yeah, no, I mean, but you do have to take note of the fact that Halo 2 was rushed. Like, it
oh, yeah.
was, they had, Bungie had heavy, heavy pressure from Microsoft to push for Halo 2's release, and they were definitely not ready. Like, if you, there's the documentaries on the Halo 2 special edition that, like, I mean, they make no bones about it. Like, you see they are, like, when they are in crunch, they are in crunch, and there's, like, moments where the guys seem like they're, like, broken. Like, we're fucked. There's no way we can make this game. And they're, like, they did everything they could to get the game out when it needed to come out. And it's like, it's one of my favorite documentaries, is that Halo 2 documentary.
I didn't see that. I've never seen that.
You can find it online for free. It's on YouTube. Like,
okay.
It's been forever since Halo 2 came out. But yeah, it's a great documentary. You sort of, like, it's really emotional. Like, you get to see, especially when they're trying to push for the E3 demo, and it's like they worked so hard to get that E3 demo out. That is great. Like, I still like to go back and watch the E3 demo for Halo 2 because it's really awesome. But then after that comes out, they're like, they have this moment where they sit around and they're like, well, we made this really great demo, but we have not made anything for this game. Like, we pushed so hard for this demo, and we have, it's got a lot of really good concepts, but we have nothing for the actual game. And it's a really good documentary. And you get the
wow.
sense that it's like of how rushed it is. And then there's also on the Halo 3 Legendary Edition, there's one of the bonus discs has all the Halo cutscenes, and there's commentary from Joseph Staten, Jason Jones, who was the project lead for the first two Halo games, and then Marty O'Donnell, the music guy, is on there too. And like all through the Halo 2 cutscenes, Jason Jones is just listing off all the cool shit he wanted to do in Halo 2 that he didn't get to do. And you really kind of like wish you
yeah.
could have this version of Halo 2, because the Halo 2 campaign that came out was not the best.
No, but even, I think what's funny is when you describe all those conditions, Halo 2 is a much better game than what you would think coming out of that.
Yeah, especially from the multiplayer point of view.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think it feels like they switched gears at some point on development. It was like, we're really going to make sure the multiplayer is good, because they knew that the Xbox Live sort of really hinged on Halo 2, and they made, like, it's a, like, Halo 2 made Xbox Live. There were
yeah.
features in Halo 2, like friends lists and clan features and messaging. That was Halo 2. That was not Xbox Live. Like, the Xbox 360 Xbox Live that we have now is totally owes to Bungie and their Halo 2 system. And then all matchmaking systems, that was Bungie. Like, Halo 2 was, it made the matchmaking system that is, like, everything now.
Yeah,
because before, and on most PC games, it's better on PC, you would have just dedicated server lists where, you know, you host a game, and then you go through a server list, and it's like, this has 6 out of 8 players, the ping seems okay, fuck it, I'll play this game. Whereas with Halo 2, it just puts a bunch of people together in a match, like randomly selects a map and game type based on your hopper, and you go for it, and you can just do that forever.
But yeah, I mean, the campaign, like I said, it's messy, but it's got... And the story is not laid out in the best terms. There are points that are confusing, and I
yeah.
feel like we've definitely, not only us, but everyone's talked about the points that are kind of muddy. But it's still kind of got a lot of fascinating points to it, and
I think
it's a good middle chapter.
Yeah, I think if Halo 2's story had been presented better, it would be one of the best video game stories.
Yeah.
Because because the problem is that it's way too complex, and
yeah.
They're not able to sort of, like, explain it well enough and sort of get you really well immersed. But once you've played it enough to really get what's going on in the story, I think the interplay between what the Master Chief does and what the Arbiter does is done really well. The problem is that the Arbiter missions in particular fall so short that you become really disinterested in what's going on with the Arbiter
right.
while you're playing the game. And then once you get the cutscene, a lot of interesting stuff happens. But during the gameplay segments, you sort of lose track of what's going on with the story.
Right. I mean, and it's sort of interesting because you're even introduced to the Arbiter in a way that doesn't really seem to matter, and it doesn't in the grand scheme of things. You're just going on an assassin mission. You need to kill a heretic, and it hints at things down the road that this heretic is actually correct about the Covenant.
About the Great Journey.
But once you kill him, I mean, that doesn't come back into play. That's just a thing that he does to introduce who the Arbiter is.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that to a certain degree. I don't know if you need 2 hours worth of levels to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it does have, like, it introduces some elements, like, it introduces 343 Guilty Spark back into it.
Right.
And then you get some hints of Tartarus, the big brute chieftain, is not on the up and up. Like, you get, like, some... There's a little bit of that, but again, it's not. Yeah, it's not the big. Like, it doesn't sort of like drive forward the story. Yeah.
But again, I think once everything comes together in the end, the last couple levels for both the Chief and the Arbiter are fantastic. And those to me are like just great Halo. You don't actually need to make apologies for them. Those are really good. Everything leading up to that, it's kind of a slog to get there.
Yeah, other than like the very, very beginning, which to me, that's the best part of Halo 2's campaign, are the first few Chief levels. Like, Cairo Station, Metropolis, or Outskirts of Metropolis.
Those are great, yeah.
Those are the best Halo 2 levels to me.
That's where you got the big Scarab fight for the first time.
Yeah, and you this like you get the great vehicle segments in Outskirts and Metropolis.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I also have to say, with Halo 2, though, Halo 2's first cutscene might be my favorite cutscene in the Halo game. Like, there's...
Okay.
Halo 2 is because it, where it switches between what's going on with the Arbiter and what's going on with the Chief, where you see the aftermath of what happened in Halo 1, where the Arbiter is completely, like, shamed. That's when he becomes the Arbiter. Like, he is tortured and everything, but then the Chief is getting all these medals, and he has this big medal ceremony. It's, like, sort of the contrast, and it flips between that really well.
It's a good sort of mission statement that now we're going to kind of humanize the Covenant.
Yeah, you get... Halo 2 definitely is the first time you get a good perspective on what the Covenant is like. You get, like, this is, like, the Great Journey. They are religious fanatics. They have... You get the sense of the... sort of the overarching, like, government structure with the prophets. You've got the three big prophets and everything.
And the great voice work by all the Covenant actors. I mean, fucking Keith David, who is...
the Arbiter, I was going to say, he is so awesome.
And, I mean, Keith David is just one of my favorite people. And I whenever Keith David appears in anything, I love him. Voice, physically, whatever. He's a cool guy.
Yeah.
And man, is he perfect as the Arbiter.
Yeah, I agree. It's just some... I just love the first cutscene. Like, I love everything. It's not even just all cutscenes. It's also sort of like the tutorial kind of Halo 2 before you know, I need a weapon. Like, all the stuff before that, like, it's just, I love the beginning of Halo 2.
Yep, it's awesome. So, again, from a story standpoint, I mean, I think where they take the characters in terms of developing the Cortana-Chief relationship to the point where, at the end, it's a very effective and hard-hitting ending that he's got to leave her behind.
Yeah.
I really like that stuff.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think I like all the stuff between the Arbiter and the sort of the Spec Ops commander, Half-Jaw.
Yes.
I think all that stuff, because that dude also, I don't know who the voice actor...
That's a great actor,
I haven't recognized his voice in anything else, but all the stuff, like him slowly coming over to the Arbiter's side, I love that arc. Like I said, like, Halo 2 has a really good story, but the gameplay sections of the campaign sort of, like, lose you on it. You sort of just... forget about what's going on in the story. It's the first introduction to the Gravemind, who has, like, the introduction to the Gravemind is the longest fucking cutscene.
Oh, it goes on and on.
It's just ridiculous. But, you know, the Gravemind's awesome. He has a bunch of really great lines. It's kind of confusing. It takes a while to get a sense of what the Gravemind is, but because that's one of the things they don't explain that well. But, yeah, it's like Halo 2 has a really interesting story, but again, it just falls apart in the gameplay sections.
Yes. So, but I will say, it's got the cliffhanger final line that launched the biggest hype campaign ever, and it was awesome. I mean, I know some people don't kind of like the cliffhanger into 2. I just think the beat they play at the end is really fucking good. And Chief saying, "Sir, finishing this fight, and then going into the musical sting. It's great. That's what I play the game for, to get to that moment, because it's great.
Yeah, but then, again... You did not play Halo 2, like, day
3 years
one.
Before, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
It was about a year and a half. But, yeah, I mean, it was not... I did not feel your same level of pain and anticipation.
Yeah, because that's... I mean, it is
Halo 2 sets up apocalyptic stakes.
Yeah.
I mean, not just in the end with the Ark and everything. It's actually at the beginning. They've invaded Earth. I mean, there's...
Yeah, no, they've invaded Earth and all the Halos are primed and ready to go.
Yeah. That's... I mean, when you're at the end of 2, it's like... This war is about to end, and it's about to end in one of two ways.
Yeah.
And that's where we start in 3, and it's a great setup for 3. But man, I mean, I can understand if you were playing it 3 years out and you didn't even know when 3 might come out.
Yeah.
It would be tough.
I mean, because I agree, it's a really cool cliffhanger, and now when you play it, it's like, that is a really cool moment. But it, you know, like, that's a really cool moment for like a TV show episode to end on.
Okay.
It's like, yeah, like that's cool. But it's like, for video games, it's like, well, fuck, I have to wait 3 years for Halo 3 to come out. It's like,
yeah.
Jesus Christ, that's going to take forever.
It would be like if they played the end of, like, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers really differently. Like, with, you know, so, like, instead of having a sort of gradual end where Helm's Deep comes to a close and they all get to talk and Frodo and Sam have a final conversation, it's just everyone's fighting at Helm's Deep, they're about to lose, and, you know, Frodo sees Mount Doom for the first time, he's like, Sam, we're going to destroy this ring, and then it, like, cuts to black.
Yeah, it's like it ends, like, it would be like if Two Towers ended right before Gandalf came back in.
Yes.
It's just like, well, shit.
Everything's fucked.
Yeah.
So, that's Halo 2. Anything else to say about the sort of story and everything in it?
I think it's, I mean, yeah, you could sit here and talk forever about the story in Halo 2, but,
yeah.
I mean, I think we got sort of the basics
of it. The gist of it.
Yeah.
So, Halo 3. We can both talk fully about the hype for Halo 3, because it was like, the day Halo 3 launched, September 2007, that was like the most important thing in our lives up to that moment. I remember, I mean, that was our freshman year of high school.
Yeah.
And it was like, man, those first couple weeks of high school, we didn't care about anything else. It was just like, we're waiting for Halo 3, and then everything else doesn't matter.
Yeah, and that was when that's when Halo started doing just amazing commercials.
Yeah.
Where they had, like, the Believe ads and stuff, where they started doing live-action commercials. It's just, they had the, like, CG trailer, Starry Nights. It's just like, that looks absolutely amazing. And then...
Right.
Just there's like Mountain Dew Game Fuel, there's like Mountain Dew Slurp, or there's like Halo Slurpees. It's just, it was ridiculous. The amount of marketing power behind Halo 3 was insane.
Well, not only was the power insane, I will say, I think the gist of the marketing, like the aim of the marketing, was actually audacious in how much it was promising for what this game was going to deliver.
Yeah.
In terms of doing it all around the term finishing this fight, and really emphasizing that this is where the Chief is going to, like, fulfill his destiny, this is where shit is going to go down.
Yeah, this is the end to the trilogy.
This is the biggest event in this universe ever, and you get to play it, and this is it. And so I think that's where we need to jump in. Do you feel, as a conclusion, as a big final chapter, Halo 3 delivered on the hype that was promised?
Yeah, I totally.
Yeah,
Halo 3, I think Halo 3 is my favorite of the Halo games. Like, if you're combining everything, I think Halo 3 is my favorite.
Okay.
I think Halo 3 is amazing.
I can't say I disagree, because I'm not going to disagree with any individual point you'd have about the game. I think I probably reach as an overall package I like more, but it's like, how do you do that? It's just kind of like, they're pretty equal, but definitely 3, from a story standpoint, that's where my sentimental attachment to Halo is most strong, because I just feel like when you sat down to play Halo 3 and you'd had all that hype and you were so excited to see how all this story and characters that you'd come to really have a big emotional attachment in was going to end. And not only did it deliver on that, but the gameplay delivered too, where you felt like you were an active role in ending this story.
Yeah.
It's just everything about it works.
I agree. I think Halo 3 is absolutely phenomenal. And then it's also, to me, like Halo 3, sort of like that whole period where I was playing Halo 3 like all throughout high school, basically.
Yeah,
and that was just sort of like that period in my life where I had a lot of people, I knew a lot of people that I like talked to all the time that had Xbox Live. And I played fucking Xbox Live. Like, I played Halo 3 more than any other game. Easily. By far, I have played Halo 3 more than any other game. Because I have played just countless hours of multiplayer, and then like both just ranked like matchmaking type stuff, and then also of custom games. Where Halo 3 was Halo 3 was the first time they did the sort of, you can make whatever the fuck you want. With the Forge, you can make maps, and then with the custom game settings, you can do fucking anything. It was it's so hard to make a game type for Halo 3, because there's so much you can do. You can change You can change everybody's movement speed. You can change just like one person's movement speed. You can change their gravity. You can change their starting weapons. You can completely change everything on the map. You can change their damage from like all these different gradients. You can change their shield levels, their health levels,
and there are
their
so
radar,
many...
like how far their radar expands is insane.
And there were so many fun games that came out of that. We always had this game type we used to play called, you and I and my friend, some other friends, Thor.
Yeah, Grav Hammers and Thor. Gravity. That was like the first game type I made using that.
Yeah.
That
was, it was so simple, but it was
yeah,
so fun.
Yeah, it was like really low gravity, so you could jump really high. 300% movement speed, Spartan lasers, and gravity hammers. I think slightly higher health.
Yeah.
And it was like super fun.
Yep. And there was always stuff like that in 3. But we'll get back to that in a little bit. Let's refocus on the campaign.
Okay.
So, from a gameplay standpoint, I don't think there's much to say because I think it goes back to what made 1 so great and then perfects it all.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Halo, the one thing really good about 3 is that the sort of the weapon sandbox is really expanded at this point because you have all the improvements in Halo 2 and then all the you have the assault rifle coming back, you have really great additions like the Spartan laser and the gravity hammer that really sort of flesh out the weapon sandbox. And so there are Because one thing that's really good about Halo 1 and something that's also kind of bad from another point of view about Halo 1 is that Halo 1 has a very sparse weapon sandbox. You've got, like, maybe 8-9 weapons total. I don't want to count them all off the top of my head right now. But, you know, you don't have a lot of different weapons. But
yeah,
all of them serve a purpose other than the Needler, which just sucks in Halo 1. But all the other weapons, they have a function and they're good at what they do. And they're very good, like, in those specific situations. And so Halo 1's very focused. Whereas Halo 3 has this plethora of options that you have at any given moment. You can go dual wielding. You can dual wield like a brute shotgun, the Mauler, and like a brute spiker, or you can use the pistol that just comes back. That's much better in Halo 3. You have all the sort of like main like big weapons like the battle rifle, the Spartan laser, the rocket launcher, the sniper rifle. You have all the vehicle sandboxes bigger. Like Halo 3 has so much stuff in it, and then plus you have the equipment too.
Yeah.
That can, especially like with the bubble shield, that really changes how you can approach an encounter.
Right. And so it plays great. I think every bit of the gameplay feels very well calculated to give you a lot of options about how to approach it, and it's just very fun. There's a lot of emphasis on spectacle, which I think helps it live up to the hype from the gameplay side, is that every level you do at least something really big, mm-hmm. and it's really fun, and it's just, it means something, and it hits you when you do it, and it's great to play.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only a couple of areas where it feels like you start doing sort of gopher stuff, like maybe in the rat's nest level. But even then, it's like...
It's like this is the sort of like, this is your humanity's home base.
Yeah,
this is
you've
like
gotta
the
do
last
this.
Thing left and it's being attacked by the Covenant. It's the second level of the campaign.
Right.
And I really like that level.
Yeah. I think that how it's all arced, those first 5 levels of the game or so, is basically humanity falling to pieces and then kind of getting back up and making their last stand and actually doing it well and pushing back.
Yeah.
And how they, I like how they sort of gradually reverse it so to get humanity on the offense again. They do it really well in Halo 3 because coming out of 2, it's like, well, how are they ever going to come back from this? 3 does a really good job turning the tables early and often. So, and that's what I love is that because it's the Chief coming back and he says, I'm going to finish this fight, that's how you live up to that cliffhanger, is to have him come back and start making a difference immediately. You know?
Yeah.
He really rallies humanity to get back on its feet.
Yeah, there's a great moment after you, Sierra 117, when you go to the Crow's Nest level, and the first cutscene in Crow's Nest is just like you've got a bunch of really like battered, beaten troops that like see the Chief, and they're like, holy shit, that's a Spartan. Like, that's, we have a chance now. Like, we've got a walking god of war among us. He's going to rain fiery death upon our foes. Like, there's this really cool moment where it's like, we have a chance again, because the Chief's back.
So I think that's the gameplay of the campaign. I think that pretty much sums it up, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, but what we were saying, where you have a lot of different options to tackle encounters, I think Halo 3 does that better than Halo 1. Like, where you're saying you can be so creative about, it's not necessarily all the time, but there are specific encounters that, like, there's one specifically on Sabo Highway that's one of the hardest encounters in the game, is you go into this big open area where there's a bunch of brutes on like the left side of the map. As you enter it, there are this sort of like a fortified position of Marines with a bunch of little like sort of shanty like.
Oh yeah, this part's tough. I
and
played
there's
it today.
A, like 3 or 4 phantoms come in that drop off more troops, and then there's also a wraith on the other end that will start bombarding you if you move too far forward. And they're like, I've played that encounter so many times, and there's so many different ways you can do it, where they're like two sniper rifles, there you can try to get a Brute Chieftain's fuel rod gun, you can lay a bunch of trip mines around. There's a turret, you can get a shotgun at that point and try to do like close range stuff. You can move ahead and try to take that wraith, and then come back, bring it back, and then kill everyone with it. It's like that encounter, and this is just like one example of a lot of the later levels, like the Ark and the Covenant have a bunch more. That it's like there are a bunch of different ways you can tackle this encounter.
Absolutely.
Every single time I do it.
And I think it really emphasizes that for me with the Scarab encounters.
Yeah,
I've never played one Scarab encounter the same way,
mm-hmm.
or same way twice.
Yeah.
Like I always try to experiment, because Scarab fights are like my favorite thing to do in all of Halo. It's just, I get this giddy, perverse pleasure in taking those fuckers down.
Yeah.
And one time I remember what I did is, I think it's on the Ark level or the one right after it, where you have two Scarabs at once.
That's the Covenant.
The Covenant.
Yeah.
And it's the one where it's snowy and kind of dark,
mm-hmm,
and rainy.
Yeah.
And I got in a ghost, and I've played this level many times at that point. This is one of my playthroughs years later. And I got in a ghost, and I was on this like cliff, and I'm like, I wonder. I like the Scarab was moving towards me, so I just gunned it and went up the cliff, jumped off, and landed the ghost on the Scarab, and then destroyed it from there. While I was doing that, they were in my ear saying, "We've got to take out its legs. We've got to take out its legs." I'm like, "No, I just got on this motherfucker."
Yeah, no, I have a very similar one where on the one that you find in the Ark, where it's only one, and you're going down this really long sandy hill, and you have to kill. There's like a bunch of wraiths and ghosts that you have to destroy to get to it. And then once it's at the bottom of that hill, and then there's a sort of like little like ramp thing that goes up that sort of like has this interior base structure that has a bunch of weapons in it. But I had a chopper, and the Scarab drops down right in front of that like big sort of ramp structure. And I was like, I have a way to take care of this with my chopper. And so I went onto that. It's like at the end, there's a little lip, and I flew the chopper off, hit the boost, and like just like jammed it right. You know, there's like sort of the, on the front of the Scarab, it's got like that middle portion that sort of digs in, and I just like crashed the chopper and like wedged it right in there, jumped off, killed it, got back on my chopper, and then like jumped off it right when it exploded.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things that I ever did in Halo 3 campaign.
It just feels so epic, everything.
Yeah, feel like when you get one of the more creative ways to get onto the Scarab and kill it, you feel like the biggest badass in the world.
I love in co-op.
Great feeling.
I love in co-op on the Covenant level, where you'll get in one of the what's the helicopter called?
The Hornets,
and like you'll there's two of you, and one of you will drop off on it, blow it up, and then maybe even do the thing where you self-sacrifice yourself, stay with it when it dies, and then the other guy will have flown away. It just feels awesome. But no, and I totally agree with you with what you said about. I mean, I think the creativity aspect, I can't argue with that statement that it's stronger than anywhere else in 3.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great, because obviously 3, I think, is better than 1 in that regard, because it's a bigger game and it's a more creative game visually and in gameplay settings.
Yeah, and I think that's why Halo 3 might be my favorite. Like, it's right up there with Halo 1's campaign for me.
And I go back and forth on all 5 of them, except 2. But, I mean, definitely 3. I love 3. It's when I play it, I get this warm wave of nostalgia, and then I'm always finding new ways to interact with it, so I know it's not just nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know? Great game. But let's talk about the story, because this is definitely the one where we can dig deepest into the story. And I think, again, we need to just go back to Master Chief and Cortana and their relationship. And I love that not only does this kind of culminate their relationship and define it the best, that they... It's a love story to the degree that they love each other on a very pure level of just they really need each other to function.
Yeah. It's like, obviously, you have the emotionally crippled... I'm pretty sure Master Chief can't even, doesn't even have, a lust. I'm pretty sure they took that out of him when they turned him into a Spartan.
They say that in Fall of Reach.
I mean, he doesn't have a sex drive, so it's like... And then Cortana's an AI. It's based on a human brain, but still an AI. It's like... Also, she's an AI based on the human brain of Master Chief's surrogate mother. So it's like, they have this really kind of, when you get into it, they have this really fucked up relationship.
It's very Freudian.
Yeah, but it's got this very sort of, I mean, it's very platonic, but like you said, they really just like kind of need each other.
Yeah.
To, like, the Chief, and that's one of the great things about Halo 3's campaign is that you don't get Cortana back until like the second to last mission.
But that's what makes it feel so sad. But that's what's great, is that it tests their relationship in ways unlike anything else, because at the midpoint of the game, when the Ark is opened and everything, he gets that message from her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he has to take the ultimate leap of faith, and that's the moment where he has to decide, do I trust her equivocally?
Sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
He doesn't even hesitate.
Right.
Halo 3 has the best cutscenes in a Halo game, by far. Right. The cutscenes are beautiful.
Yeah.
They're big
and cinematic.
Yeah, they're really well directed. They've got, like, the music is just so good, and it's just, the cutscenes are so much fun to watch. Like, I just like watching the Halo 3 cutscenes.
I do, too. And again, there's that choice of saying, you know what, I trust her absolutely, mm-hmm. To the end of the world.
To the end of the fucking galaxy. Like, I'm going to go outside the galaxy, and I'm going to stake the entire galaxy on this.
And then, what's so great about that is that she, by recording that message and saying that, she's also put her trust in him, and when he comes, it's him who makes the big decisions of how he's going to finish this,
mm-hmm.
and she put her trust in the right place because he finishes the fight, and he does it right, and he does things that no one else could do when he goes through that portal. And I think, I love that sense of, I mean, I don't want to use the word destiny, but it's definitely him fulfilling his arc as a character from birth to now. And going back into that pod at the end is that he's fulfilled his mission in life.
He's ended the Covenant War and destroyed the Flood.
Yeah.
Like, he's done it. Like, he's done the impossible.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think...
I think it's a pretty deep character exploration at points.
I think so, too. Particularly with Cortana, because... it's almost kind of a Guilty Spark situation, but played much more tragic than it is kind of funny, where you don't know... I mean, that's part of, like, the thing that they don't know if they can trust Cortana, because they don't know how far Cortana's gone, because she's been with the Gravemind the entire time. And when you find Cortana, she's kind of broken at first, and I think...
That, to me, by the way, that's my favorite cutscene in Halo. If I had to do a default, is them reuniting, because the tender music, and it's really one of the first times you've ever seen the Chief just kind of relax and be tender for a moment.
Yeah.
And just, I love that image, will always be burned into my mind, of him kneeling down next to her
and
talking,
like,
her back up.
Yeah, I can... Yeah, that's a good call. That is probably the best cutscene in the Halo games.
So, there's such this sense of satisfaction to that. And then once you're there, it's like, now we are literally at the end of all things,
mm-hmm.
and we're gonna make one last stand.
Yeah,
and then you go out, and it's just that last level, the level called Halo,
mm-hmm.
is interesting, because it's, you do feel like you're at the end of everything, because it's all desecrated and it's dead, and there's just the Flood left. And it's, you know, you've got one last shot, and somehow you pull it out, and mm-hmm. it's great, and it feels earned, you know? I mean, that was, I think, the biggest challenge from a story standpoint, is how do you end this massive Covenant and Flood war, and human, you know, this, like, three-way fucking war, in one story, and with one basic action, and they find a way that feels earned.
Yeah, and feels totally appropriate, and it's completely genius, the moment where... they bring back Installation 04, the Halo from Halo 1, where the Ark is remaking it, and it comes back up, and you decide how you're going to solve this, is you're going to light the ring on the Ark, because that's where the Gravemind has gone. And it's like, just that, it's such a genius way of ending that story, and as soon as, like, that thought has, like, occurred to someone, that is the way the story has to end. Like, there's no other way that conflict could have been resolved. It's like, that is the most appropriate way to end that game. And it's sort of how it sort of mirrors Halo 1 and all the callbacks to Halo 1 that feel, they don't feel like cheap callbacks. They all feel really earned. Like, when Halo starts, and when the mission Halo starts at the very end of Halo 3, and you go to the area that's the big complex that leads up to the map room from Assault on the Control Room, it's like you have this instant wave of recognition and nostalgia. That is so incredible, because it's like you instantly recognize that facility and where you are. That you're back on Halo, and you are going to actually light the ring this time. You're not going up there to stop it.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's just great. And I love that, again, talking about how it's earned, is that it's a solution, but it's not a perfect solution, because... sacrifices are made, major sacrifices.
Yeah.
I mean, every Marine who went through that portal...
Yeah, no, dies. Everybody who went through the portal dies. Like,
yeah, except the Chief and the Arbiter.
And the Arbiter. But even then...
And they're kind of,
They really barely make it.
Yeah, they barely make it, and Chief makes a big sacrifice in that he's...
Yeah, the Chief arguably doesn't even really make it. I mean, if Halo 4 had never been made, he wouldn't have made it. Like, he would just been lost in space for all time.
Which, I mean, we'll talk about that in a second, why that's a perfect ending for him.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I mean... not only do you have all these Marines, and the Marines just as a group have kind of grown very endearing to you, but then there's individual characters like Sergeant Johnson, who gives his life, and it's a great moment. And I mean, it's a tearjerker. That moment.
It's really sad. Because the whole, like, last, like, the starting with the Covenant and then all that last area, that's like, that's really emotional to
me. It is. Because there's big emotional moments with the Arbiter, too, where he finally gets to pay back Truth for what he did and kind of save his race and all these things. But, so you've got those big payoffs, and then again with Johnson dying, you definitely feel the toll of the war in the end, and I like that. It's not a clean-cut ending. It's, shit went down, but maybe we can rebuild now.
Yeah. I mean, because you have Miranda Keyes, who she dies.
Oh, I forgot about her. She dies.
That's a super sad moment.
Well, that one's just a kick in the nuts because nothing is accomplished. That's just...
Yeah.
You think she's going to do something big, and she just gets shot down, and that's it.
And then, like, Johnson carries her body back on the Pelican. It's like, all those moments at the very end of the game are really powerful. I think they're really, really well done.
Yeah.
Sort of like, to me, it's sort of the apex of storytelling in an action-based first-person shooter.
Absolutely. And then, I mean, getting... And also Guilty Spark being the last enemy, and you having to gun him down. It's great. And then, of course, repurposing the driving finale of Halo 1, but on a huge scale.
Yeah, it's like, it is crazy the shit, where it's like everything is just blowing up. There's like the moment where the big tower just sort of falls and like just knocks away the entire like first half of it, where it's like, I guess I have to turn now then.
Yeah.
Okay? I thought I could drive a little further, but nope.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to hang a left.
And I mean, every time I play that, I get tense and nervous. And like when I'm playing it with a friend, and it'll be like, something will happen where we get knocked out of the warthog. It's like, go, 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 get the fuck back in! Get in now!
We are fucked!
Yeah. There's like flood everywhere. It's like, oh, start shooting! Start shooting! It's awesome.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and then the actual ending, I mean, I think... That scene after the credits, and I like that they hold it after the credits, because I think it feels really right there.
Yeah.
Of the Chief basically, there's nothing else left. It's like, it's not just circumstance that puts him back in that pod, it's that he's fulfilled his function, and now that's kind of, he's saying, you know, wake me when you need me. Without war, that's kind of all he is.
Yeah, it's like what would the Chief have done if he had gone back to Earth, right?
Right.
Like, there would be nothing left to do. He's done everything the Chief needs to do. He just doesn't have a personal life. Like, he has no other function.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could have done a very, very effective ending with him dying. But I think I like this even more. Even if there had never been a Halo 4, that feels like the right ending for him and Cortana.
Yeah, I agree. It feels more appropriate. And I do love the fact that they wait till after the credits, because it's like you have the entire credits where you feel like, he died. Like, you assume he's dead, and I watched the entire credits, because the music is so fucking good.
Yeah,
I was like, I didn't watch the credits, I listened to the music while the credits played. And then that comes up, and it's like, yeah, like, that's how this should be. Like, even though it would have felt appropriate if the Chief had died, it feels more appropriate that he survives, but he's just drifting in space now.
I think that's one of the biggest narrative challenges 343 is going to have now, is... Someday they're going to have to do another ending for the Chief. And I wonder what it's going to be, and I wonder if they'll be able to bring him back to a point as satisfying as this one.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they've got three...
I trust him, I'm just saying. It's like, you know... Like, it would be interesting if they develop him to a point, though, where maybe he could find something else to live for or something. It's like,
yeah, maybe he can finally go back to Earth and just, like, live during peace.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting way to sort of take that character.
Right. So, it's very interesting... Great game, great ending. I mean, there's really no other, I mean, the game series that I've played, I know there are others that sort of do this, but telling a story like that and getting to that point and those levels of emotional payoff in a game where the story started off as something kind of sparse.
Yeah.
And grows to this thing that is just that mammoth.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, like I said, as far as action first-person shooters go...
Sorry about the siren, guys. There's every time we record a fucking podcast... Some asshole's probably out drinking and getting stuck in a tree.
You know, maybe someone's like, they're probably making a podcast right now, and he lights up a match. It's like, that's what I like to think.
Okay.
I have some sort of arch nemesis out there.
All right, what were you saying, Sean?
I actually don't remember. What was I saying? Do you remember? Something about Halo 3, probably.
It's awesome.
Yeah, Halo 3 is fucking awesome.
Multiplayer is awesome.
Multiplayer is awesome.
You were kind of talking about it a little earlier. Do you have anything else to say about sort of your just general memories of playing this as an experience, as a package?
I mean, God, I have so many. Especially, I have so many fond memories of after when they started, like, around when ODST was coming out, they had this the Vidmaster challenges, which were these new sets of achievements. They were worth zero gamer score, but they were these really, really hard achievements that carried over into ODST that once you've got all of them, you unlocked recon armor in Halo 3. And so I had a bunch of my friends, and we decided, fuck it, let's try to do this. And the Halo 3 one was you had to beat that last mission, Halo, on Legendary with the Iron Skull on, which meant that if any, and it's four-player co-op, so if anybody died, everyone got, like, reset to the last checkpoint. So that makes it very difficult, because people die all the fucking time on Legendary, especially when you're playing with a bunch of assholes and idiots like all my friends. So, but then, the real kicker is that once you get to that last section where they do the race to the Forward Unto Dawn, where normally you get in a Warthog, but on Legendary, with the Iron Skull on, four ghosts spawn under one of the ramps, and you can, and they're like in this little like side hidden area, and you have to get the achievement, you have to make that run with everybody in a ghost. And so, and it is much harder to do that in a ghost than it is in a Warthog. And so, we did that for fucking hours. But it was like at this point where it took us like an hour just to get to the point where you, and that's like probably the shortest mission in the whole game.
Yeah.
Is that one. It's not that long. And so it took us like an hour just to get to the point where we do the last race. And that last race was probably 2 to 3 hours of just us like, you motherfuckers, you do not drive off the fucking edge again. It's like, when that tower falls, stop and turn left. Don't keep going, you fucking idiot. What the fuck are you doing? It's 3 a.m. I want to go to bed. Stop being a fucking dumbass. I have cursed at more people trying to get that fucking Vidmaster, all of those Vidmaster Challenge achievements. It's like, because more of my friends are fucking assholes and they're fucking idiots, especially when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and they are on no sleep and running on Mountain Dew. It's just like, you know, you'll just start fucking each other over just because you hate each other at that point.
Yeah.
Like, we all hated each other after we got those achievements.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you said it really well earlier when we were talking about Halo 3, that Halo 3, from a video game standpoint, that was high school. That was freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, and a little bit of senior year, then we transitioned into Reach. But that was almost our entire high school careers. Not that we spent all of high school playing Halo, but
I mean,
from a video game standpoint, that was our focus. And it was like, yeah, I don't know if I didn't play it quite as much as you, I know, but I still, I mean, that's the game I associate with those years.
Yeah.
Is Halo 3. And I popped it in this morning and went on matchmaking, which still works flawlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, waves and waves of nostalgia. My first game, it was funny, I just went into Team Slayer, and it put me on Slayer on Narrows. And it's like, oh, Slayer on Narrows. I've done that so many times, and I love it. And I still immediately knew. I go here, I grab two SMGs, I go through the grav lift, and I start firing. It doesn't even matter if someone's there or not, because if they are, that's what you gotta do. So when you land, you are fucking firing.
See, for me, on Narrows, it's always, I go to the grav lift, and I wait till someone on the other fucking side goes on their grav lift, and as soon as they go off, I go off, and we hit each other in midair, and we both die. It doesn't help your team at all. I do that. That is all I ever did on Narrows as soon as I thought that up. It never did anything for anybody. It just slowed the game down. I did it every fucking time I tried to do that on Narrows. Because Narrows is probably one of my least favorite Halo maps. I may have ruined Narrows for myself as soon as
I know.
It's like, as soon as I come up with it, it's like, I can't not do that this time.
I know.
I have to do that every time I play Narrows.
Well, I guess we should talk about with Halo 3 also. I mean, I think Reach is much more significant in this regard in terms of how Forge was used.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously 3, it was really fun making stuff and playing fan-created maps on the big Forge.
Yeah.
The different like sandbox maps they'd make.
Yeah. Once and they decided to make the sandbox maps. And one of because I'm terrible at Halo 3 Forge. I mean, I'm not particularly good at Halo Reach Forge either, but Halo 3 Forge, the people who made, like, the big maps once Foundry came out, and they're like, I'm going to make a giant race course that encompasses the entirety of Foundry, or I'm going to make a maze using teleporters and, like, the crazy shit that people have come up with.
I have no idea how they
like,
did that.
I'm going to make the Millennium Falcon using Forge, and I'm going to turn it into a multiplayer level. It's like, it's like the passion and the dedication it takes, because Forge was not made to do that. Like, you couldn't phase objects through each other. You had to spend, like, just minutes just lining things up. Every single object you wanted to, like, if you wanted to make a walkway, you had to spend time just, like, barely nudging it, trying to get it to line up.
And yet, it just felt like infinite possibilities.
Yeah, like, you had all these constraints because the interface was kind of cumbersome once you tried to do really complex stuff. Because the Forge in Halo 3 was not designed to do that. Like,
right.
I can only imagine working at Bungie and just like, what the fuck are these people doing? Are they crazy? This is amazing! Like, I didn't even know you could do this! You're, like, doing this crazy lag thing where you, like, exit out of the game midway through where you're picking something up and it phases through another object? I didn't even know that was fucking possible!
But that's great. I mean, it's so fun because Halo 3 almost immediately became bigger than anyone who made it. It just became a platform. I mean, Reach really emphasized that. You know, where Reach is, it's its own platform.
Yeah.
But... 3, man.
Yeah, Halo 3 also, I think, we haven't just, like, really just said that, and Halo Reach did it as well, but Halo 3 has this full suite of features that it's like, when that happened, when, like, Halo 3 came out, you're like, this has so much. This is campaign. It's got, like, the full 4-player co-op campaign experience. It's got the skulls as terminals. It's got campaign scoring, so it's got massive replayability with co-op and campaign. And it's got multiplayer. It's got custom games. The custom games are completely fleshed out. There are more options in Halo 3 custom games and then subsequently Reach than there is in any other game. I've spent so long just trying to think of anything that even came close. There's nothing other than PC games, but those aren't even built into the user interface. That's like you have to go into like the developer console and like hack the game basically to... get the customizability level on the PC, where it's like, Halo 3, you can make whatever game you can think of, then add Forge so you could customize the maps, and then add the theater mode where you could go back and rewatch clips in full, like, games from a full variety of perspectives. And once that happened, you assumed every game has to do this now. It's a Halo Reach has come out, Halo 4 is about to come out, and Black Ops did a theater mode. It's like that is
a really, really shitty theater mode.
I don't have Black Ops, so I can't speak to the how good the theater mode is in it. But it's like every single game should have that. Like should have that level of customizability, and none even come close. Like Halo 3 has that full suite of features that makes it this massive package that nothing comes close to touching, other than other Halo games.
Right, I mean, and then Reach just widens the gap.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
4 will just widen the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And that gap's going to keep widening, and at this point, I don't think anyone even has a shot of closing that gap, because it just keeps widening.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where I'm baffled that it hasn't become the standard now, because
I know.
It's like, that should be... To me, that's one of the most, like, revolutionary things about Halo 3, is not, like, it's the most incremental upgrade in terms of gameplay. Like, it's fundamentally the same as Halo 2, but they add a lot of sandbox elements. But the combination of the full suite of features that they put into it is what makes Halo 3 revolutionary as a game to me. And it's like, the video game industry is not caught on to that revolution.
No, and I mean, I know for a fact, you and I both paid $150 for our copy of Halo 3 because we bought the Legendary Edition. It would have been worth more than that. That game is
Like I said, I have spent more time playing Halo 3 than I have spent time doing anything else. Like, unless you like broaden it out and say like watching movies in general, probably not. But just like of doing one specific thing, Halo 3, hands down. Like I've spent more time doing that than anything else.
It's great. And I mean, we made a movie in Halo 3, you and I.
Yeah, there's
several,
like,
but
Halo 3, all of that stuff, like the Forge in the theater, made Machinima very accessible and very easy to do.
Yeah, I mean the Red vs. Blue guys still use Halo 3 for Machinima in season 10. That's actually not a knock against Reach's capabilities. It's just graphically they needed what 3 looked like.
Yeah, and
but
thematically.
Yeah.
Sort of like ties in, but yeah.
Yeah. But no, it's great, and I want to talk about the Legendary Edition for a minute, because that's still the coolest game-related thing I've ever bought.
Yeah.
That set. I mean, it came... I remember, because we bought... I reserved Legendary, and I assume you did too, because we just read about all the features, and it looked awesome. You get this big Chief helmet.
Yeah.
You get these bonus DVDs, these bonus discs, books, and things like that. It looked really cool.
Yeah.
But then when you actually got it, it was like, oh my god, this is better than I ever dreamed. It came in this giant black box. It was the size of it was bigger than the Xbox box, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Huge. And you open that up, and then the Chief helmet. It was like a million times greater than I thought it was going to be. And I still, every time I look at that thing, I think it's so cool. It's the coolest thing I own, I think, as like a term of physical memorabilia. It's just so cool.
Yeah.
Have it up there on my mantle, right next to the TV. I had it there since 2007. We have, now yours is up in our apartment.
Yeah, with my fedora on it.
Yep. And it looks great. And I love that you can take the helmet off, and that's where 1, 2, and 3 are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they stay. And I love the little ritual when I will go back to play anything from the actual trilogy of taking the helmet off and.
And it's like it always makes me think of the opening cutscene to Halo Reach, where the guy's looking at his helmet. Like I always think about that when I take the helmet off.
Yep. So great Legendary Edition.
Yeah, and all the bonus content in Legendary Edition, like that cutscene thing. I've watched that twice now, the developer commentary, because it's so.
I need to watch
it's
that.
So interesting. They like just the perspective behind it is so fascinating. With particularly Joseph Staten and Jason Jones, because Joseph Staten was the lead writer and Jason Jones was the project lead.
Yeah,
and it's like. They have a lot of really interesting things to say about Halo 3.
So the next game would be Halo 3 ODST.
The next game would be Halo Wars. Halo Wars came out in 2008.
Okay. Talk about... I do not own Halo Wars. Halo Wars.
Yeah, I just feel like... Halo Wars is awesome. I have it. I think it's the weakest Halo game. I didn't even really, lump it in with the others because it's in...
That's a different studio. Strategy
it's game. It's Ensemble Studios, sort of like last hurrah before they got a... shut down by Microsoft, but it's the only good RTS game on consoles, still. I mean, nobody else really tries to do it anymore, whereas I think the Halo Wars formula works well. The campaign in Halo Wars is not that good. The cutscenes in Halo Wars are fucking awesome, because they're all fully CG, and there's one cutscene, it's like the second to last cutscene, where you have, Sergeant Forge, one of the main characters, is going to make this big sacrifice. The story in Halo Wars is not that good, but, you have this group of three Spartan 2s. They're like the red team. They get lost. Like they're just like this ancillary group of Spartan 2s that exist now in the fiction that who knows whatever's going to happen to those guys if they'll ever come back. But they're hold down this bridge, and it's just like this 3 minute long cutscene of just those Spartan 2s kicking ass. And it's an awesome cutscene. But yeah, Halo Wars, I think the best stuff in Halo Wars is if you had do 3v3 multiplayer. The multiplayer community is probably dead at this point, because it wasn't a hugely popular game, but, Halo Wars was fun. I think Halo Wars kind of gets a bad rap because it's sort of the black horse of the, or the black sheep of the Halo franchise, because it's the only RTS game.
I haven't even played it, and I've never viewed it that way. I viewed it as something that was a really cool... side thing for people who liked that kind of game. I don't have any strong opinion of an RTS either way, so I just never really played it. But I thought it was neat that they branched out and gave that to people who may have wanted something like that and kind of expanded what Halo could be. I always thought I don't need a million Halo games that are like one another. Go ahead and do something different. That's cool. Do stuff like that.
Yeah.
If anything, we could do more stuff like that.
Yeah. No,
other kinds of games. Yeah.
I mean, the
Halo Mario Party. Where's that? Just kidding.
Yeah, no, don't. That's...
Halo Party. Cortana's Toad.
I want to see... Okay, I don't want to see this. This is when Halo dies, is when they have a Halo kart racer. thank God we got past that trend, where in the PS2 era, every big PS2 franchise has a fucking kart racer. And it's the only good one that I'm aware of is the Crash Bandicoot kart racer, and even that's not my favorite.
I feel like you could do so much with that, though. You could have the Rainbow Road of Halo kart crasher levels, or kart racing levels, would be just Halo itself. You'd go around in a giant fucking ring.
Yeah, you just, the only level anyone wants to play is they just remake the ending to Halo 1, the Maw. I think, just in my head, if I had a Halo kart racer, I'd play a grunt every single time. I'd always be the grunt.
It's funny because actually Halo has more built in to accommodate that than most series, because it's got so many vehicles and
you
characters.
You can play racing games in Halo 3 and Halo Reach. They have tracks.
Yeah, they're great.
I mean, yes, but Halo, going back to Halo Wars after our Halo Kart Racer side trip. See, Halo Wars is fun. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't played Halo Wars, it's probably not worth it now unless you're a really big Halo fan and you want to play the campaign and sort of get some of that. But the stuff that happens in Halo Wars is not really pertinent to the rest of the Halo universe, the Spirit of Fire, the ship goes off, finds this Forerunner artifact, it's basically a shield world, and then it gets lost, it loses its FTL drive, so it's just floating in space like the Chief, so it's probably never going to get picked up on again, but so for a fun little side game, came out in 2008.
Alright.
Most people pass over.
Now, what year was ODST?
2009, the next year.
Okay.
In a weird way, there has been a Halo game that's come out every year since Halo 3. It's
in a weird way.
It's not like Call of Duty, where there's just been a main Call of Duty title every year since fucking Modern Warfare, I guess. It would have been Modern Warfare. But yeah, you've had Halo 3, then Halo Wars, then ODST, then Reach, and then Anniversary, and then now Halo 4.
Yeah, it's weird to think that way.
Yeah.
But, no, the ODST was the next big one, and even, and ODST is technically an expansion, and it really is, because the basis of it is just Halo 3.
Yeah, it's the only Halo game that doesn't have a new, like, sort of, like, foundational engine behind
it. Right. And, I mean, the multiplayer is all the same, except for Firefight, but that's still local.
Yeah.
You can do online custom games, but not matchmaking.
Yeah.
So the attraction of ODST was the campaign.
Yeah, and the sort of the different perspective that it offered, where it's set, like, sort of in the middle of Halo 2, or kind of after Halo 2. It's kind of hard to pin it down right in, like...
Well, because they overlap. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's because it's the... You know, the game starts where Halo 2, like, the middle of Halo 2, where the Prophet of Regret's ship slipspace jumps out of the Earth's orbit and, like, sort of, like, fucks over New Mombasa. And you sort of just crash down. And again, the Halo 3 ODST storyline doesn't necessarily tie into any of the big stuff that happens in the Halo universe, but it's this really focused sort of character-driven story about these group of ODSTs, so you're not a big hulking god of war walking around the streets of Mombasa. You're a human being, and having that additional perspective on the Halo universe, I think, is really interesting.
I think it's great, and I think it's a phenomenal campaign. I mean, I think
I completely agree.
I think it's, in its own ways, as good as anything else in the Halo series.
Yeah.
It's very different. I mean, I just love how much of a good... It's almost like a great break from other kinds of Halo games, because it's just, it's its own thing. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of core with the shooting and the weapons and the same kinds of enemies, but the way you play it is totally different, especially with the really, really cool structure where you're the rookie going around and basically finding artifacts, and then you'll launch into a big flashback.
Yeah.
And so there's these long... It's almost like a noir...
Yeah.
In the present, you know, time stuff where you're just walking around these empty streets. Graphically, it's beautiful. I mean, it's the same engine, but they pushed it even further.
Yeah, the sandboxes, or the skyboxes in Halo 3 ODST, particularly in the nighttime sections, are fucking awesome. This is like, especially when you go to, like, it's like the Mickey one where you find the detonator, and it's like either the big bridge leading up to the Oni facility.
Oh,
yeah. You go there when you're the rookie and you see it destroyed and it's like on fire, and it's fucking beautiful.
It is. There is a haunting beauty to all of ODST, and I think that's what makes it such an important addition to the universe, is that it's not really about what any story points are achieved. It's more about finding this perspective of other people who existed in this world.
Yeah.
You know? Because you've up to this point, you've been the most important person in the Halo universe.
Yeah.
The guy who wins everything.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're just... I mean, the ODSTs are very crucial, and especially this unit, but they're still just... They're cogs in a larger machine.
Yeah.
But seeing that perspective and seeing, you know, sort of the little guy's perspective on this massive, universe-shattering war is great, and I think it's really important, and I love the way it's laid out. Every level's really good, really tight, gameplay's great. It really even further pushes that ethos of being creative in your strategy, because now if you want to just go and mow guys down, which you could do in other Halo games, you're going to be fucked immediately.
Especially if there are any brutes or hunters. I mean, hunters particularly will fuck you up in that game.
Oh, yeah.
Because you are slower, you cannot jump as high, and you have a lot less health. So.
And when you get shot and your shields go down, your vision is impaired, all these other things that I think work really well. But, man, it's great. Works really well. And they do some fun little things with weapons, where it's the same weapon sandbox, but there's some additions.
Yeah,
the
you don't have dual wielding anymore.
Yeah.
They have the new SMG and the new pistol.
New SMG is awesome. It's like, they redeemed the SMG so well in that game. Still not like I'm going to go out and say it's the best weapon ever, but I like using it in ODST. It's fun.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And the pistol's good. It's not quite to the levels that we'd get back to in Reach, but very good. And just a fun campaign with a really tight, good story.
Yeah, I think also the special note, the soundtrack in ODST
is awesome. Oh, phenomenal, yeah.
Like, because it takes those sort of noir elements. It's got some really awesome, like, saxophone going on.
Yeah.
It's great soundtrack.
Yep.
Then also, the cast of Firefly basically voices the characters.
The male cast of Firefly.
Yeah, yeah, like, you've got Nathan Fillion, you've got Alan Tudyk, you've got Adam Baldwin. It's like, fucking awesome.
They're great.
They're really good.
Yep, and I forgot until I played 3 today that Nathan Fillion is all over 3 also.
Yeah, no, Nathan Fillion, Alan Tudyk, and Adam Baldwin also voice Marines in 3.
3, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, they're really good in ODST. ODST is very a funny game. It's got lots of great dialogue and exchanges.
Yeah.
The characters are very well drawn. You grow to like them all. You know,
firefight mode in ODST where
you pick the
characters and you have, like, the character voices coming through.
Still in Reach. I still play as Buck.
Yeah, no, me too. I'm Nathan Fillion all the time.
He's great. Awesome. So, And I think, just talking about Firefight, you know, I've gone back, we played ODST last weekend, and then we played some Firefights. While I really love Firefight in Reach, and I think they did a great job opening it up and having all these other kinds of Firefights you could do, the way Firefight is so structured and difficult in ODST, that's still my favorite kind of Firefight.
Yeah, I think I like the Firefight in ODST a little bit more, too.
It's just great. I mean, it's a fucking grind, and it's tough, but it's really great, because, again, it's all about strategy.
Yeah.
And what I love is that each map is a complete, you play it completely differently. There's mm-hmm. no two maps in the ODST Firefight, like, map box that you play the same way.
Yeah.
So
when you play Firefight in ODST, you either play Crater or you play Lost Platoon. And you really only play Lost Platoon because it's got the Warhog.
Yeah. Lost Platoon is the one you can get furthest in there. I mean, I don't know how you get to the end in some of those other levels. That'd be so hard. But
You don't. You get the achievement for it, and then you're like, I'm going to go play Lost Platoon.
Yeah. Anyway, but still very fun.
Yeah.
And I guess the question with ODST was that a $60 game to you?
I think so, personally. I do understand that other people would be frustrated. Like, to me, I'm so invested in the Halo universe that that's really what warrants the $60 purchase. And, you know, I got all the achievements in ODST, so I played through, like, Heroic, Legendary, got all the Sadie Story side collectibles, I did all the Firefight achievements. And so, to me, I got the value back. But I can understand other people. It's in a gray area of whether or not it should have been, like, $40 or $60.
I agree. I think I can see it. And where I come down is that, you know, I've paid $60 for games before that had much weaker campaigns than that, and they were just a campaign. They didn't have the Firefight stuff and all that. And, I mean, the other thing is ODST did come with a disc that was the full Halo 3 multiplayer suite with all of it on the disc, and that was a really nice thing
to have. Yeah, it had all the maps. And plus the new ones. Yeah, plus the last map pack. The last three maps.
So, and I thought that was, you know, helped too. I mean, obviously, if you had all that before, a lot of it was redundant. But again, having it all on a disc and not having to load it, and this was before Xbox kind of revamped how that all went with, like, installing the drive, that helped a lot. It helped load times.
Yeah.
Helped things. It was a nice disc to have, nice archive. And that's usually how I still play 3 multiplayer if I'm going to play it.
Yeah, no, that definitely put in the ODST multiplayer disc.
Yeah. So I totally think it was worth $60. Again, I've paid $60 for games that just had a campaign, and it's like, that's fine, but not worth $60.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Those games are also not worth $60.
Right.
I definitely sympathize, because the ODST campaign is really good, but it is really short. You can knock that one out in about 4 to 5 hours if you're playing well.
No, I agree. It's in a gray area, and I like that for anniversary they put that down at $40.
Anniversary would have been kind of frustrating if they had put it at $60.
Oh, absolutely. But anyway, so let's talk about the next, you know, major installment in Halo Reach.
2010 Halo Reach.
Which, I mean, for all intents and purposes, was Halo 4 in a technical sense. It was the
fourth. It was the next iteration on the Halo gameplay, but it was a prequel in terms of story.
Yeah. So I do think it's always kind of weird that they're calling this new one Halo 4. It's not bad, I'm just saying it's a little odd, because I've always thought of Reach as 4.
Yeah, to me, this is kind of a tangent, but I wish that they called Halo 4 Halo Reclaimer, because they're labeling it the Reclaimer Trilogy anyways.
Yeah.
And there's just something about, like, I mean, Call of Duty realized this really quick, that once you start moving past 4 on, like, numbering your series, it starts feeling awkward to me.
I don't trust that they're going to go to Halo 5 and Halo 6 and just call them that.
I think they are. I think it's going to be Halo 4, Halo 5, and Halo 6.
I would like that, but that would be kind of unprecedented for them to be...
I mean, we're Final Fantasy fucking 14,
man. That's true.
Like Call of Duty... It's like getting to a point where it's getting too big for just the Modern Warfare subtitle now, where they're going to have another slap another subtitle on there and start numbering those. Because once you start getting past 4, it's just like, Halo 5, really? Even though I love Halo, there's just like this like thing in the back of your head when you hear that, you're like, come on, guys.
Well, Halo 5, but it's actually Halo 6.
Yeah.
You know, these sorts of things. Anyway... Reach is my favorite overall package of the Halo games. Today, again, that changes depending on when you ask me, as you can understand, probably.
Yeah.
And I guess I would say that I've probably spent the most time in Reach. And obviously that's a gray area, because Reach has not been out as long as 3, but I just know... I don't know if it was just the refinements and perfections they made in Reach or whatnot, but there's something that always... Reach has been a standby for me since the day it came out. It's been very rare that even a week's gone by since it came out that I haven't played some Reach, and I really love it, and I haven't ever really gotten burned out on it. There's always something brand new to do because of the fire, the not the firefight,
the daily challenges, the weekly challenges,
the challenges, and the Forge World, and all the new Forge maps, and all the new game types people make. And I love that side of it, and campaign, because of challenges and things like that, yeah. There's always new ways to play the campaign, and the campaign is so damn good, and so challenging, but never bad challenging. I mean, I will just say this up front, Reach, I have played through on Legendary, I've gotten that achievement, it's my proudest achievement on Xbox, playing it solo on Legendary, Monument to All Your Sins achievement, yeah. Because that is the hardest game I've ever played.
Dude, have you played Halo 2 Legendary? Halo no. 2 Legendary will... Fuck you.
Okay.
It will fuck you.
Yeah.
I mean, Halo Reach Legendary is probably the second hardest, but man,
but in terms
Halo
of fair 2. Challenge?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Halo 2 is really fucking cheap. The Jackal Snipers.
Yeah.
Fuck Jackal Snipers. Fuck. No. I hate Halo 2 Legendary. Halo 2 is... Do not play Halo 2 on Legendary. That will ruin your day.
Yeah.
Once you get to Jackal Snipers.
But man, Reach, I mean, I just have... that. I've never been more invested in playing a Halo campaign. So in terms of, like, not necessarily from a story standpoint, from a gameplay standpoint, than when I did it on Legendary alone, and just the amount of, like, intellectual energy it took to get through that, and just, like, the drive it took to, like, force yourself through parts of it. It's tough but fun. So
yeah.
But let's start with campaign. What,
okay.
In terms of sort of gameplay refinements, we're back to single wielding.
Yeah.
You're a Spartan again, though, so it's sort of similar.
You're a Spartan 3. Like, there's... Halo Reach is a really interesting one because, I mean, this is like the thing where a lot of people say it's like, you know, oh, every single Halo game is the same. A point of Halo Reach, fuck you, Halo Reach is a very different game. You've taken out dual wielding, you've added reticle bloom. Reticle bloom is a big deal where you've semi-automatic weapons like the single shot DMR, pistol, needle rifle, those kind of weapons. When you shoot them, they're semi-automatic, so they'll fire almost as fast as you can pull the trigger. There's like a limit on it. But your reticle will start expanding out, and you'll become less and less accurate, as opposed to the battle rifle, where every single three-shot burst was the same accuracy. Reticle bloom, hugely fucking controversial. Like, I don't know how much I like it, but it's like, a lot of the Halo competitive community did not like that. But
I will offer my view, because I've played a lot of Reach.
Mm-hmm.
And I see both sides of it, because I do enjoy sometimes playing the title update version they have now without it,
mm-hmm.
where they've gotten rid of it. But I always liked Reticle Bloom because I think it fit the strategic element of Reach that I think that game was going for, excuse me, from a gameplay side. And in terms of how much of that game is about cover and shooting from a distance and those sorts of things, but it also disciplines you. And I like how much it disciplines you.
Yeah.
And I think it works very well in that regard, where I just think there are rhythms to that game that, because of the Bloom, is very different than how you would play the rhythms of 3 or 2 or 1.
Yeah.
And I like that. It adds a nuance to it that I don't think was there before in how you shoot and how you fire from a distance.
Yeah, no, I agree. But it was sort of one of the elements that added to a sort of slower style of gameplay where your movement speed was reduced, your jump height was reduced, you had the reticle bloom, so you had to consciously pace your shots, whereas with the battle rifle you fired as often as you could, as long as you were aiming the right direction. And so a lot of those elements sort of like pushed the Halo gameplay in a slightly different direction. They also had, fucking melee even is completely different because there's no bleed through on shields with melee. So you have to pop their shields and melee them to kill them. Whereas before in Halo games, your melee would bleed through, and if they had a low shield, you could kill them with melee. Grenades are different because you're a lot slower. Vehicles are much more susceptible to small arms fire. You've got fucking armor abilities. Armor abilities completely change the way you play the game, where you've got sprint will make you much, much faster. Jetpack is, like, ridiculous, where you can jetpack like a motherfucker. Like, you can go from the bottom of a map to the very top of a map using the jetpack. There's armor lock, again, huge. The armor lock was massively controversial. I don't think armor lock is as big a deal as most people make it out to be, because it's annoying when people do it, but every time someone armor locks, I end up just killing them anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, the armor abilities completely change the pace of the game. Like, the Halo Reach is the most different from the other Halo games there is.
Right.
So, like, anyone who says every Halo game is the exact same, go fuck yourself. Totally not true. Go play Halo 1 and Halo Reach back-to-back and see how different they are.
It's almost... It's tough to do that.
Yeah.
But, no, I definitely think Reach... I like all the enhancements they made, and I like the tweaks. To me, it feels like the best version of Halo we've had so far. And again, I say that it's a razor-thin margin, and I get that, but I really do like it, and I just how you play it both in campaign and in multiplayer, it just there's something about it that feels right to me over maybe some of the others. And it's almost like I can't even describe what the individual elements are. I just like the tweaks. I like the more measured pace of it. I like that. I like how you do it in campaign. And focusing on campaign, obviously this game has a phenomenal story and with a lot of weight to it.
Yeah.
And that's what's most notable about the story side. And I think you can describe the story of Reach pretty simply. It's definitely a team story where they do some... You've got a lot of great personalities on your team, a lot of good characters... And they die one by one as you're on this dying planet, and I think it's one of the most dramatic Halo stories easily.
Yeah, because it's a completely foregone conclusion just based on the fact that it's a prequel, and then also if you're knowledgeable about the Halo universe, you know Reach gets fucked. Reach gets fucked hard.
Yeah.
Reach is the biggest military stronghold that humanity has, and when the Covenant finds it, that's a massive blow.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of like spells the doom for humanity. And then, like, sort of leads into what happens in the Halo games, where humanity gets by like, the skin of their teeth.
Right. And I love that, because there's very little else like that in the gaming world of you basically playing, and you know you're losing.
Yeah, you know you can't win, really. You can get to the end of the game, but you're not winning the war.
No.
So you're obviously not winning the war. You're not even winning back the planet. You are making sure as few people die, and then once you get to the end of the game, you realize you need to get Cortana onto the Pillar of Autumn.
Right. And I think that's one of the coolest things is they find a really legitimate and kind of organic way, even though they're fucking continuity in the ass.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah,
totally just fucking with... They bend it over the table and have their way with it.
Yeah, Fall of Reach gets, like... I mean, the whole last part of Fall of Reach basically gets completely...
rewritten.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of, like... Like, I have a way in my head it sort of works.
I do, too.
But with Fall of Reach, like, the book, like, they're not compatible directly. You can take the events, but you have to ignore the fact that nobody has any idea that Reach has a month-long invasion instead of, like, a day-long invasion.
Right. And the stuff with Cortana, too, is very, very different.
Yeah, yes, Cortana's all... Well, I mean, I think there's a whole, like, the Cortana thing that you have isn't fully Cortana, it's a Cortana fragment. And the whole way they find... Like, they imply in Halo Reach that the Forerunner artifacts under the Forerunner facilities under Halo, under the planet Reach, are what lead them to the Halo artifact, and that was already explained in Fall of Reach. It was like a different Forerunner thing.
I don't think any of this is bad, I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, but it is like... I mean,
to make a good game, they had to do something.
And Fall of Reach was written when Halo came out. Like, they didn't know when they were making Fall of Reach the book that Halo was going to become a huge thing. It was sort of like this interesting little... attempt at, like, oh, we're going to make a novel for a game.
Right.
No idea it was going to explode the way it did.
Yeah. So it's fine. I'm just saying. Yeah. They have their way with continuity, and that's fine. But, no, the story is very interesting. That I love that while this planet is literally dying around you, you do have a mission that is hugely important, and the sacrifices your characters make in the game don't just mean something. They mean everything.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good way to approach that game, and it's a little unlike any other game I've ever played, and I love that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And obviously I don't think Halo Reach has quite the punch of 3 because it's not the characters you've been following for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it comes damn close at times, and that's a huge accomplishment to me.
Yeah.
I think that speaks very highly to how well they characterize the game and how just good everything in it is. I don't think the cutscenes, for instance, are as cinematic or powerful as 3, but they are what they need to be for this game.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of the characters in Halo Reach come across a bit like sort of like stereotypes, like June and Emil feel like they're Barry and Carter to a certain extent. Feel like these are just the...
They're not the same level of characters as in the trilogy, but I think they're, again, I think they're what they need to be and what they can be for this story.
Yeah.
You know? So...
But I love George.
Like, George is awesome.
George is awesome.
It's great. So, a lot of great moments in it. And again, I've played this campaign many times. Ground through it, and I feel like because of playing Legendary, you probably know this too. If you play Reach on Legendary, you wind up knowing every fucking inch of that campaign because you spend enough time in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the campaign. I think every level is fantastic. Each one is very solid on its own. There's no... It's almost hard to say which levels are better than others because it just feels very consistent.
Yeah, and a lot of the levels feel very unique. Like, it's got a really good pacing where you don't feel like you're doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Right. Well, I mean, and probably the best level in the game is Long Night of Solace, where you go into space. And you do every type of Halo gameplay possible in one level, and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
So, just so much fun stuff in it. I love it. I do think, Again, 3 from a sort of a story, emotional side is my favorite campaign. I probably like Reach for playing best. Again, because I think the way they have done weekly challenges and stuff, it's fun to just go back into Reach campaign levels and just start having fun with them, you know, at different points. So
I remember for a few of the Halo Reach levels, I did the weekly challenges where you have to do a mythic playthrough, which is legendary with, like, all skulls on. That's fucking hard.
That's fucking hard.
When I say I played through it, I mean you cheat your way through it, basically. You find some help online, and you're like, I am going to glitch through this wall and bypass the enemy spawn because there is no fucking way I'm getting past that turret. That is literally impossible. I can't even fucking see my gun because I have the blind skull on. So it's like, fuck you guys. I'm phasing through the wall.
I have never actually completed one of the lasso challenges, but I came very close on Long Night of Solace. Died right at the end, and I threw my controller against the wall and walked away. That was that.
I did like the first 3 or 4 levels. Yeah.
It's
hard. Very hard.
Very, very, very hard.
It's like I wouldn't have done it if the weekly challenge credits were not so worth it.
I know. They are worth it. They're cool. I've always loved the challenges aspect. But definitely where Reach excels for me is a whole package. Campaign's great. And do we have anything else to say on it?
No, I think other than I think the best part of the entire Halo Reach campaign is the very end where your character dies.
Oh,
that means dies. I think that's
one of the most audacious moments in all of gaming.
I think it's a really great way to end that game.
Yeah.
And you're not really expecting it.
No. But that's awesome anyway. But I think the multiplayer in Reach is just a thing of beauty. It's great. And it's evolved so much in these last 2 years and grown. And it's just a wonderful gameplay community. And the base maps themselves are really good. Even though I don't like it when they just pull the maps out of campaign or take the maps and put them in campaign.
They took the maps and put them in campaign.
Right.
They're multiplayer maps first.
Yeah. And again, it works perfectly.
Yeah.
It's just I kind of like it when they're separate. It makes the game feel bigger, but it's not a huge issue.
Yeah.
Because you've got a lot of maps. Some of them are just for firefight. Some of them are for, you know, multiplayer. They're all really good. They're all balanced well. I think they're really fun to play on. All the Forge maps that people have made and kind of been accepted. There's so many great, fun, and creative ones. And it's just great to play. I love so many different game types. I've spent so much time in Reach. It's such the actual, like, infrastructure of the game and matchmaking system is just fucking flawless. With the veto system where you can actually vote for different things.
Yeah.
And it matchmakes so fast. Everything about it just works perfectly, you know?
Yeah. One thing that I really love about Reach as an entire, like, package is sort of the... Your Spartan 3 is consistent throughout all of it. You know, you make sense. You don't the sort of standard story characters. You make your own Spartan, and then he progresses through the ranks. You get credits. You use your Spartan in campaign, firefight, and multiplayer. You unlock armor
pieces. Feels
very
personal.
Yeah, it's your Spartan is your Spartan, and I really like that about Halo Reach. Especially, it's really fun just to be like, you know, I'm going to have my dude look like a complete idiot and just watch some cutscenes. Like,
yeah.
I've watched the first cutscene to Halo Reach so many times, just being like, I wonder what it looks like when I have this armor on. Like, I'm just going to be a tiny George. Like, I'm going to put some credits, I'm going to make myself look exactly like George, only he's tiny. And I'm going to watch the cutscenes like that.
You can even make yourself a woman and have that. And it's really interesting.
You can be a female Spartan.
Played campaign as a female, because it's fun to have the different voice.
Because they have their voice actors different.
So,
obviously, it'd be really weird if the voice actor is the same and you're suddenly a female Spartan.
No, but it's awesome. And I don't know how much we can say about Reach, because it's like it's still kind of ongoing, you know?
Yeah, I definitely think you were right in saying that it's even more... I mean, Halo 3 had it too, but Reach even more so is a platform. Like, it's...
Yeah.
With the added Forges, particularly with Forge World, you're able to make so many different kind of games. You're able to make so many game types in different maps that are just good maps.
And I mean, it's nuts. Like, Rooster Teeth, for instance, on Achievement Hunter, has multiple game, like, series that are just stuff in Halo Reach.
Yeah, they have the
Horse.
Achievement Horse, and then Halo Reach Fails of the Week.
Yeah.
They're just, like, stuff from Halo. Particularly Achievement Horse, where it's just, like...
It's a game show.
We're going to make a fun little, like, trick map. And just, like, let's show it off.
And Thomas and I, for a while... I mean, now we got burned out on it after a while, but... Because Horse has gone on so long.
Yeah.
But... We would always watch it every week, download the maps, and then play it ourselves. And it was a fun thing to do.
Yeah, some of those maps are super creative. It's still impressive to see what some people can come up with.
Absolutely. So that's why Reach, I think, again, just an incredible gameplay value. If I were to, like, if I knew how long I'd spent playing Reach and then broke down the like cents I paid for it, I'd be both sad and overjoyed that my money went that far.
Yeah, it's like with Halo 3, I'm in like fractions of pennies.
Yeah.
Like,
just... So those are the games. Anything else to say about all that?
I think we covered it pretty well.
Yep. Halo Anniversary would be the next release.
Yeah,
it's just Halo with a new coat of paint, and they did a beautiful
job.
Yeah,
the coat of paint is awesome, though.
Yeah.
I think it's really, especially if you're a big Halo fan, it's fun to see that campaign with like sort of like the little art things they throw in. Like, you know, in Pillar of Autumn, they put Linda like status screen because in the fiction she's another Spartan who's like sort of half dead and cryogenic freezing, and they put her status screen up in like the cryo room. There's fun little Easter eggs. The terminals in Halo Anniversary are really fucking awesome.
They're awesome. And the graphics are beautiful. I just love going around that game and switching back and forth between the old and new engine, which that's the other thing that was nice they did is having the old engine in there.
Yeah.
So you can really just play it like that if you want,
mm-hmm.
if you're a purist. It's got a fun, very, very fun set of achievements.
Yeah, the achievements are. I mean, the only one I haven't done, I'm going to do it at some point, eventually, is the... legendary run on library in like 30 minutes or less.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. That's the one I haven't done either.
I mean, that's one where you basically have to find a walkthrough online.
Right.
I don't speed run Halo. That's not my thing, so
no.
I have to
figure
out how to do that.
Yep.
That one's hard. It was hard enough. The other one was like you had to beat the library on Heroic without dying. It's like that was tough. That was like my fifth try. Luckily, I played the Halo 1 campaign so many times.
Right.
It's like... And I played it like probably three times through on Legendary. It's like, you know, with Heroic, I can do pretty good on the library. But Legendary, 30 minutes or less, that's a pretty tall order.
Yeah. And Anniversary added some fun new multiplayer elements into Reach and maps and stuff. So, you know, they prolonged the life of that multiplayer suite too. So,
yeah.
It's a damn good disc.
Yeah, I think it's totally worth its value.
Absolutely. And it was just good to have that campaign preserved for years to come in a new form. So, I liked it.
Yeah,
so that's all the Halo stuff. That's our big retrospective, so back to Halo 4, coming out in a couple of days here, or not in a couple of days, one day here, and that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's...
So, we're on the eve of another new Halo.
And we're on the eve of, I'm going to only be playing Halo for weeks after this game comes
out. Oh, yeah.
It's going to be crazy.
Yeah, that's going to be the game in the Xbox.
Yeah, that's...
If you change it... Like, if either of us changes it in the apartment, we're going to have to, like, punch the other person. It's like, you made me get
up. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Get away from the disc tray. What the fuck are you doing? What are you thinking?
Sit down and play Slayer,
damn
it.
You fucking idiot.
So, what are you most excited to experience when you buy Halo 4 and come home and play it?
Main menu. It's just, like, that moment. Like, that's where I meant with, like, Halo... I just love the fucking menus. Like, I love that moment when I get a new Halo game and I put the disc in and it's like...
They do have great menus.
Yeah, it's like, this is the UI design that they're going for this one. This is pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
It's like, I just like getting the menus. I'm looking forward to this. Like, I have to decide, it's like, how am I going to try to customize my multiplayer Spartan? I'm just going to immediately jump straight into campaign. It's like, at what point do I start fucking with my controls? Do I wait to see if they do the default or converted thing? It's like, I don't know. It's like, I'm so excited for Halo 4.
I know. Me too. I will say, first thing I will probably do is look at controls, because I loved the control scheme in 3 so much that I've just kept that one. On Reach, they had an option. They switched things back to like X being reload, and I tried that for a little bit. Wasn't overly fond of it. I've always liked reload being up on the right bumper, so I just changed it to that, and that's how I've played Reach. I'll probably do that again in 4. And
melee on the right bumper kind of guy. Really like that in Halo Reach. I really like the Halo Reach control scheme. Well, it's fun to look at the control schemes for Halo 4 because they have default sprint and armor ability. So it's like they had to really get creative with some of the control schemes where it's like, you know, the default control scheme makes a lot of sense. And then like Halo has a bunch of different like bumper jumper and boxer and all those, green thumb, where they're like, how the fuck do we do that where we have default sprint and we have armor abilities? Like, that's where do we put all those fucking buttons now?
Yeah, but Xbox controller, it's versatile.
Yeah, it's...
So I'll probably do that, and then, I don't know, I always kind of, before I kind of commit to campaign, I'll play a little bit in multiplayer, probably.
You are a heathen. That heretic. That's...
Okay.
That is blasphemous that you would go into multiplayer before finishing campaign. That is evil. No.
How's that evil?
It's like, you shouldn't... For any game that has a campaign, you always beat the campaign before you touch multiplayer.
Okay.
That's like video game rule. That's video game law. Some sort of like... Because you might... There's like that danger that you'd be that dude. Like every time I see the guy in Halo 3 or Halo Retreat, like just like idling at the one like before the multiplayer match starts. You're like, oh, let's look at this dude's thing. It's like, you haven't even beat campaign. What kind of a scum of the earth are you? You haven't even fucking beaten the campaign. Like, I want to find this dude and slap him. Because you always beat the campaign before you touch multiplayer.
Okay. Well, then I'll play the campaign first. In terms of whenever I get to multiplayer, I don't know what I'll play first. I'm definitely excited for SWAT, because I'll say this. SWAT is my favorite game type in Halo. It's kind of become my favorite thing to do in Halo. I don't know why. I can play SWAT for hours on end, literally. It's just there's something about it that I have so much fun with. And I think they could expand it a lot in 4, and I'm excited to see how they do it.
Yeah, I've seen some videos of people playing SWAT.
Yeah.
Looks cool.
I'm excited to see all the maps, because they are separate from campaign.
Yeah, they've got like 13 multiplayer maps this time around.
So they look
with
cool.
Three of them are Forge environments. So instead of having one Forge world, that's three cool. Different unique Forge environments, so not every single Forge map is going to look the exact fucking same.
Right.
Which got a bit old in Halo Reach, I will admit.
I mean, it was as much as they could do at the time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the big issue, but it's, you know, 2 years out and I'm like the...
It's so grass and gray.
Yeah, the grass and the silver Forerunners, it's like, I kind of need to look at something else when I play a multiplayer map.
No, but it's like, it's such a big experience, it's cool. And it's kind of interesting, I've read about, you know, the details of it, to push the 360 to the levels they've pushed it, they've had to put this game on 2 discs.
Yeah, no, the multiplayer is its own separate thing that you need an install for.
Right.
To be able to do it.
So you install, like, this base thing under it, and then you just play everything from disc one. But I think that's nuts. It's awesome, but it's, you know...
I mean, although I should say, for me, the aspect of Halo 4 that I am... You know, I'm going to play the campaign first, but the aspect of it that I'm most excited for, and, like, sort of, it's just almost like the entire philosophy behind the game, but it sort of boils down into Spartan Ops.
Oh, absolutely.
That idea of, like, finally, it's, you know... Because the episodic gameplay thing sort of, like, started popping up in, like, 2005, 2006 with Half-Life 2... And it's like, finally, someone has an idea of how to do episodic gameplay that will work in anything that's not an adventure game, like Sam and Max or The Walking Dead. It's like, it's like, this is fucking genius. Like, to me, the idea behind Spartan Ops seems pretty revolutionary. That's like,
I agree.
And then I also, but it sort of ties into the whole philosophy of, I also like the idea of multiplayer having a sort of narrative context. I think that is really, really cool. It sort of, like, is a step further where, with Halo Reach, you know, you had your, like, persistent Spartan, and obviously your Spartan's not going to be in the campaign for Halo 4, but the idea that my Halo 4 Spartan avatar, like, has some sort of place in the actual Halo universe. Like, the Spartan Ops are, it's the actual story taking place in the Halo universe that my custom avatar is participating in, and then also the war games are simulations being run on the UNSC Infinity. I think that's an awesome idea.
It's cool. It's just a nice thing that they can push for, and it just shows that in every little detail they're innovating.
Yeah, like to me, that's like that idea to me is just very revolutionary. Yeah. Where most action first-person shooters in the multiplayer, it just like take place in this vague sort of space where it's like, you know, every like Call of Duty match is like this weird ethereal skirmish taking place at this like overgrown mansion. It's like, and that happens every 12 minutes. Whereas with Halo 4, it's like, yeah, okay, this is cool. This is really cool that this has a narrative context that I can, like, get into and, like, feel. It's like this multiplayer match has some sort of significance.
Yeah. So, before we end, I've gotten on Amazon.com just to check my order of Halo 4, hoping it comes in time. Still saying shipping soon. That worries me a little bit.
Yeah, mine's at the same spot.
But they'll do it. They'll be okay. They're probably giving everyone one day shipping and they'll get it here in time.
Yeah.
But if they don't, I'll just go to Best Buy and buy it anyway. And then Amazon has a good returns policy. So.
And then you will return it to them with a bomb. It's just like, fuck you guys. You made me wait like an extra hour or whatever to get my Halo 4.
It would be weird because that would be the first time Amazon had ever failed me on that. But oh well. That's not true. Back in 2002 when we bought Harry Potter on DVD, it came a day late.
They were like, this is a piece of shit movie. Let's not send this kid.
Sean is an asshole.
But what, 2002, would that have been Chamber of Secrets?
No, that would have been 1, because 1 came out in 2001.
Oh, yeah, 1 is even worse. God, why would you want to watch that movie?
Anyway, Halo 4 tomorrow. We're excited, and we will see you next week, and we will, we'll review campaign, we'll give our impressions of what we've done in multiplayer
I mean, I can only imagine how much I will have to say once I've played Halo 4. That's going to be a long podcast. I'm going to be playing a lot of Halo 4 come Tuesday.
Well, we'll do that, and then we'll also do a review of Red vs. Blue Season 10. Now, if these two discussions are too big, we may do two podcasts next week. I think that's a very real possibility, and that's fine. We can do that. But maybe we will do two. But anyway, it'll be next Monday. We'll get all that started. And again, if we feel... we could actually do one later this week for Season 10 if we feel like there's going to be too much on Halo 4 alone. But we'll see. I mean, if you subscribe to the show on iTunes, obviously, you'll get episodes whenever they come out. So, this is a busy season, though. I mean, we're going to spend a little bit, you know, this first half of November talking about Halo. And then, you know, The Hobbit comes out in mid-December, but there's other things in between there still.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot to talk about before the end of the year.
And then plus the fact that Halo 4 is going to keep on continuing with Spartan Ops that I imagine will touch on that probably most podcasts, whatever's happened in those.
Thank God Doctor Who has ended.
Yeah, we went through this weird period where we're like, what the fuck are we going to talk about on the podcast? And now we're like, what the fuck are we going to talk about on the podcast? There's too much stuff.
Yeah. I guess more is better than none.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this has been our second, 3-hour area podcast in a row. We hope you've enjoyed them. We hope you probably haven't even gotten through our last podcast by the time you started listening to this one.
Yes, but, that was a late one in the week.
Yeah, so you know, take your time listening to all this. We'll be back in your ears next week. And enjoy Halo 4. Tomorrow will be a glorious day, no matter what happens with the presidential election. Because Halo 4 will be there.
Fuck it, Master Chief for president.
Absolutely, Master Chief for president.